Well, we'll begin with Representative Root. If you would like to speak to your bill, and I know that there's a delete all amendment, and that's what we'll be discussing this evening. So, Representative Root.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's a pleasure to be before you here today. And I first want to thank all of you for braving the elements and sticking around. And I also want to thank all the people, there are many of them in this room, who have worked for many years on this issue. And I want to acknowledge that and thank them. And I also would like the record to reflect that there is a blizzard going on outside, and there is tornado warnings in Kansas today. So I just thought I'd throw that in there. Several weeks ago, a historic event took place on the floor of the House chamber. We had members of the House and Senate Committee for Agriculture, Environment, and Energy gather to hear about global warming. And we heard from clergy, we heard from scientists, and we heard from Minnesota's own native son, polar explorer, Rick Steer. And we learned that global warming is not just an environmental issue, it is an economic issue. I have a plugged ear, so you just tell me if I'm yelling, because I can't really hear myself. It is an economic issue, a social justice issue, and a moral issue. And we as policymakers have to take that into consideration as we write policy for the state that will impact generations to come. Each year when the legislature convenes, the dominant issue seems to kind of bubble to the surface. And we as legislators don't necessarily get to pick what that issue would be, but rather the people who elected us do. And this year, the issue that really seems to be dominant is the issue of energy. And global warming is intrinsically tied to the issue of energy. I believe that the people have spoken, and I believe that they want us to take action on this issue. And I think the reasons are varied. We all feel the impact of rising fuel costs, whether we're going to fill up our car, whether we're trying to warm our homes, or our house, or our businesses, or our schools. But there's something else going on as well. The people in Minnesota notice that our environment is changing, and it is having an economic impact on our state. Ask our winter resort owners, well, maybe not today when it's snowing, but that little snow translates into a smaller tourist industry. Or ask Dr. Fralick from the University of Minnesota, who's described to us how our forests are changing and what that will mean for our timber industry. Or ask our farmers, who have been experiencing a drought and then have to deal with flooding when they have intense storms. While higher energy prices and the effects of global warming present challenges to us, they also present opportunities. And we have an opportunity to put Minnesota in a leadership position on the issue of global warming. We won't be nation leading because other states have already taken action, but it's time to join those states and take action. Federal leadership would be ideal, but that is not happening right now, and that does not give us an excuse to sit and do nothing. We can take action so that Minnesota will be poised to be in a strong strategic and economic position. We are in the midst of an evolution. The days of a carbon-based economy are limited. Carbon dioxide is a byproduct from burning fossil fuels, and we depend on them today. While it may be necessary to continue to burn fossil fuels, we cannot continue to do so without recognizing and including more of the real price we are all paying. Over the next few months, you'll be hearing a lot about carbon and about cap and trade. Simply put, cap and trade is a market-based method to reduce pollution, and it works. It's proven itself in the use to reduce sulfur dioxide emissions. Now, because the recognition of more of the true costs of burning fossil fuels, carbon emissions are becoming a new commodity. Six states on the East Coast are moving ahead with cap and trade. Six states in the West just announced that they will also be moving forward with that. And on Tuesday, the headline in the Christian Science Monitor read, Wall Street adds climate change to bottom line. Investors are paying attention to the real financial risks associated with climate change. Global warming is in the minds of Minnesotans, and they want us to take leadership and action on this issue. And with that, members, I would like to turn to the bill. I'm going to go through that. I do have some testifiers, too, where there's obviously a lot of people here. I just want to say there is a Bleedell amendment, and I believe members and the audience have that in their packet. And that Bleedell is the result of many conversations that I've had over the past several weeks with many people in this room. And I just want to acknowledge that I'm committed to working on legislation that is strong, effective, and functional. And I want to extend a special thank you to Bob Elof, who has been very patient and very helpful as we have worked through this process. So the bill.
And just before you begin with the bill, I'll call the meeting officially to order. We do have a quorum, and we could very quickly approve the minutes if there's somebody who would like to approve the minutes.
So moved.
Representative Scalzi moves the minutes for February 27th. 2007. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes have been adopted. And Representative Rood to the lead all amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Clearly, if we are to reduce our emissions in the years ahead, we need a plan to get us there. And the governor has already begun a planning process, and we applaud that effort. This bill, however, and this bill kind of builds on what the governor is also starting by having a multi-stakeholder process that brings together a cross-section of Minnesotans from different sectors of our economy and society. But with how this bill differs from what is in the governor's bill is that we set goals for the stakeholders. We want the stakeholders to be very focused in their efforts. And so we give them long-term reduction goals to plan for. And it's critical to tell the stakeholders where we want to go so that they can figure out how to get us there. It's also important to send a signal now to those who are planning to make long-term investments in Minnesota that they cannot assume a future of unlimited greenhouse gas pollution. Quantifying goals in this bill helps steer investments in a direction that will help us meet the goals rather than move in a direction that will undermine them. So Section 3, I believe I just recently saw this. I hope my numbers are right when I'm referring to them. I'm talking about, I'm not going to necessarily walk through the bill page by page. I'm going to go through it rather so it logically makes sense. So the first part I want to refer to is the Section 3 that speaks to the goals. And it establishes three reduction goals. And the first goal, the longest term goal that's out there, is 80%, that we want to reduce carbon emissions 80% below current levels by 2050. And this is a number, members, that is based on science. And this is what science is telling us that we need to do to avoid dangerous global warming. The shortest term goal is to reduce to 15% below current levels by 2015. And it is only slightly more aggressive than the governor's own goal of reducing the state's per capita fossil fuel use by 50% by 2015. And we believe it is a goal very much worth planning for. And the midterm goal is to reduce to 30% below current levels by 2025. And that's designed to keep us on track. We also ask the stakeholders to work on a plan to get us to 45% of that same year, just in case as time marches on, the science tells us that we need to be more aggressive in this process. The planning process will result in a set of recommended policies and their estimated costs that will be brought back to the legislature next year for debate and implementation, so as a way to help us to achieve these goals. As I mentioned, in other states already have targets, and we do have some handouts here. Paige, who could, thank you. Many states around the nation have established their own reduction targets, and you'll have a handout, and you can see that. And you'll see that the targets that we have picked are not the most aggressive, nor are they the least aggressive. In another part of the bill, you'll see subdivision. We don't have the right numbers, I don't think. It talks about cap and trade. And what we are asking the stakeholders process to do, we want them to be focused, and we want them to come up with a plan for cap and trade, deciding how to achieve the reduction target. We want to make sure that that is one policy that they are considering and that they are focused on. And as I mentioned earlier, cap and trade is a concept that has been around for a long time. It's widely recognized as the most efficient, flexible, and market-friendly way to reduce greenhouse gases. And cap and trade is, as I mentioned, is the mechanism that was used to reduce acid rain pollution over the last several years. We know that this process works, the cap and trade, we know that that works. We don't need to wait a year to have the stakeholders come back to the legislature and tell us that we should consider cap and trade. We want them to start that process so that we are ready when other states take action. We also want to join in on that process. The other provision of the bill that is sure to draw some criticism, I'm sure, is that it's got a no backsliding measure. And it will take a year for the stakeholder plan to come back to us, and of course, additional time to implement the recommendation. And this bill has what we call an anti-backsliding provision to make sure that in the meantime, we don't make major increases in our emissions while we're figuring out how to make major reductions in those emissions. The sector that poses the greatest risk of causing large emissions increases before we could have a reduction plan in place is the power sector. For example, a new coal plant of 600 megawatts or so would emit the same amount of greenhouse gases as roughly 700,000 cars. And unlike our cars, a coal plant lasts for decades. And so obviously such a long-term commitment to technology like that would seriously undermine our pollution reduction planning process, and it makes it much harder to make the reductions that we know we have to have. And so the bill would prevent new power plants from being built unless they could offset their carbon and dioxide emissions. And on this concept, we agree with the governor, who similarly requires new power plants to offset their new emissions. Where we disagree is over what would represent acceptable offsets. And we believe that it's critical that pollution reduction projects used to offset a new power plant be real and verifiable. And our bill would allow two kinds of offsets. First, a plant could offset its emissions by reducing the carbon dioxide emissions of an existing power plant. And second, once the states that are ahead of us and have the allowance up for cap and trade and have them for sale, the allowances, they could participate in that. Section 6 refers to resource planning. And finally, the bill would make sure that the financial impact of anticipated carbon regulations, and particularly those expected at the federal level, are factored into resource decisions made by utilities. We know laws are coming that will impose new costs on global warming pollution, and we want to make sure our power sector is realistic about the financial risks of increasing pollution at a time like this, so they can take steps to help reduce that risk. Before closing, let me just say one more thing about future climate regulations at the federal level. The fact that we know federal regulations are eventually coming and that they will impose new costs on fossil fuel use means that the choice before us is not between a world where carbon is regulated and one where it is not. The choice before us is between actively preparing for the carbon-constrained world we know is coming, or just continuing to race down the path of business as usual, ignoring the changes ahead. Clearly, it is far wiser for us to plan for these changes so we can both reduce the risk and maximize the opportunities for Minnesota, and that's what this bill is about. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Rood. And as I had said earlier, we have many people who want to testify. We have a couple of people who have traveled from out of state. We're going to allow them a little bit more time than the others to testify since they came in from a great distance. That includes Dr. Alden Meyer, who's Director of the Strategy and Policy Union of Concerned Scientists. He's the first on the list to come forward. The others, if you could try to keep the statements to between 3 and 5 minutes. As I say, there's several people here, so I'd like everybody to get a chance to testify. But again, the two that are coming in from out of state, probably give them 15 minutes or so, or less if they can, in order to testify. So is Dr. Meyer here? I'm sorry.
Thank you, Chairman, for this opportunity to testify to you today. I grew up outside of Buffalo, so this is like old home weather for me. Matter of fact, it's kind of wimpy. We used to get 36 inch snowstorms and live to tell about it. So I just want to start out by saying it. I think it's undisputable now that the global warming, the danger is real. The science is clear and compelling. The most recent report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change said with 90% or more confidence level that humans are responsible for most of the observed global warming. As we're seeing, the impacts are already being experienced, and they will become more severe over time. We're in danger of crossing thresholds that would trigger major and potentially irreversible processes like the rapid disintegration of the Greenland or Antarctic ice sheets. And what concerns scientists is we don't know exactly where those thresholds are. We're sort of gambling with the planet's future. And in this case, uncertainty makes scientists more worried, not less. The impacts on the Great Lakes region will be large, and I'll come back to that in a minute. But we need to look at the flip side of this. The Chinese have an ideogram for danger for crisis, which is a combination of danger and opportunity. And the flip side of the danger we face from global warming is the opportunity to deal with it. By implementing solutions to global warming, we can create jobs, good jobs. We can strengthen our rural communities as states that have already implemented standards like renewable energy standards, as you just did recently here in Minnesota, found out. We can reduce our vulnerability to energy price shocks from oil price surges triggered overseas. We can save consumers money, and we can reduce other environmental impacts on air and water. I think you have in your packets the executive summary of a study we conducted with a number of leading scientists from around the Midwest region. We can get you copies of the full report if you'd like to have them. But let me just show you this slide on Minnesota. We did these slides for the states in the region, and you can see here by the end of the century, based on the scenarios and the models that were run, Minnesota in the summer will feel like you're in southern Wisconsin or Illinois. I mean, the winter will feel like you're in southern Wisconsin or Illinois. In the summer, you'll feel like you're in Kansas. So if that's the kind of future you want and try to have the state adapt to those kind of climatic shifts, you can sit back and do very little. You'll also see considerably warmer and probably drier climatic regime. You'll have threats to your lakes, your wetlands, and your waterfall, and more extreme events and flooding. The opportunity is that you can implement clean energy solutions, and these include a range of things you're familiar with energy efficiency and the full portfolio of renewable energy sources. Renewables, we've done a lot of work on this since our report Powering the Midwest in 1993. It's no surprise the Midwest states are importing most or all of their fossil fuels. With renewables, you have no fuel to mine, refine, or transport or store. You have zero or low emissions from the technology. You decentralize your energy supply and buffer against volatility in prices and, of course, as Representative Rude just said, against the prospect of future environmental regulations, and you can benefit consumers in your economy. You've probably seen these kind of slides before. The Midwest is the Saudi Arabia of wind, particularly Minnesota and the Great Plains. In Minnesota, you have the technical potential to generate 8 times your current electricity use. You have tremendous potential also on biopower, second only in this region to Iowa, not surprisingly, in terms of the percentage of your state's electricity sales that you could produce from a variety of bioenergy resources. You also have tremendous solar potential. It may surprise you, you have greater solar potential than Houston here in Minnesota, and you're close to Miami. And there's good correlation of that solar resource with your peak electricity demand. And, of course, installation of decentralized solar also delays the need for expensive upgrades and politically difficult upgrades in transmission capacity and distribution capacity. Renewable energy costs have been falling as a result of the national and international research and development and increased deployment of technology. There's more work to be done there, but breakthroughs are occurring every year. 2 years ago, the Energy Information Administration estimated that new wind supply in Class 6 regions, such as you have here in the Midwest, would be cheaper than advanced coal and nuclear power technologies. And that's despite what we believe are several overly pessimistic assumptions about wind technology and costs, and overly optimistic assumptions about some of the fossil and nuclear price assumptions. The benefits of a more aggressive clean energy approach for Minnesota is delivering major reductions in global warming while boosting your economy, turning you into a net exporter of clean energy and clean energy technologies. You're already a leader on renewable electricity and biofuels. As a result of past legislation, we believe this bill would be a good next step for you. As Representative Rood noted, the politics of global warming are shifting rapidly. Clearly, media coverage and public awareness is increasing. Big new constituencies are joining scientists in the environmental community in this debate: hunters and fishers, agricultural interests, evangelical community, and others. There's growing business support for mandatory limits on emissions. More Republicans, particularly in the United States Senate, are distancing themselves from President Bush on this issue. And the front runners in both parties in the 2008 presidential campaign are committed to action. There's growing support for action by the private sector. You're probably familiar with the announcement last month by 10 major companies and 4 non-governmental groups calling for cuts in emissions of 10 to 30% by 2020 and 60 to 80% by 2050. In addition to the 4 utilities that were part of those 10, there's several others that support cap-and-trade legislation, including the new owners-to-be of Texas Utilities, which until last week was committed to building 11 new coal plants in the state and supporting several others out of state. Even ExxonMobil is changing its stance. I had the opportunity to participate in a climate dialogue a few weeks ago sponsored by the Center for Clean Energy Policy, and the ExxonMobil Vice President for Environmental Health and Safety was there, engaging actively in what the shape of federal cap-and-trade design should be. This is a World Resources Institute chart that just shows the emissions path associated with the various bills that have been introduced in this Congress. The gold standards are the Sanders-Boxer bill and the Waxman bill in the House, Sanders-Boxer in the Senate. Those would be on a path to 80% below 1990 levels by the middle of the century, 2050. There's a range of other bills introduced out there. And, of course, Congress is a marketplace of ideas on this issue. There's hearings held every week. It's hard to keep up with what's happening in Washington. The prospects for legislation, people ask me, what do you think the chances are in this Congress before 2009? I think there's almost certain to be some Senate action. Getting to 60 votes needed to overcome a filibuster in the Senate is always a tall order, but momentum is building, and I don't think anyone would say it's out of the question. There could be action. Clearly, the House Democratic leadership, Speaker Pelosi, wants action on this issue, but all roads lead through Chairman Dingell in the House. And he is starting hearings and just asked the stakeholders to submit comments by mid-March on what they think the key elements of design of a cap-and-trade system should be at the federal level. The President, as you know, has opposed mandatory limits on emissions, but there are many that think that he would sign a bill that passed the Congress with significant business support. And as I said earlier, if a cap-and-trade bill isn't passed this year or next, it will be a high priority for the next president in Congress. You've seen this chart just showing the growing number of states that are taking on greenhouse gas emissions targets. I understand that there's a state senator in Wisconsin who may be introducing a bill shortly in that legislature as well. And just this Monday, the Environment Committee in New Jersey unanimously approved a target for that state, endorsing Governor Corzine's 80% reduction goal by 2050. So there's a bandwagon effect happening here. As you know, California has been moving forward with its AB 32 law. It's just been joined by 4 Western governors in announcing that within the next year they want to design a Western regional approach, a cap-and-trade system in those states. There's indications that Nevada and possibly Montana may join the party soon on that. Northeast states are moving forward on the regional greenhouse gas initiative, and as I mentioned, the New Jersey legislature has just started action on the governor's goal. In the Midwest, Governor Blagojevich has appointed a climate change advisory committee that we and other groups are serving on, along with industries and others in Illinois, designed to report back to him by early next year on what the state's approach should be to meet the targets he's laid out. Advantages for states that take action now, I think this is a key point. Building on what Representative Rood was saying, you will position your economies and your industries to do well in what is inevitably going to be the low-carbon economy of the future. there is going to be federal action and increased international action. The question is when. But I think there are a few people that would say 10, 20 years from now, we will not have constraints on emissions and prices associated with carbon pollution. You will also increase your attractiveness to clean energy and vehicle technology companies. This means more investments and jobs, as a number of states that have moved forward with aggressive renewable energy targets can already tell you. You'll gain experience with cap and trade and how it works. Excuse me. And you will have a greater influence and a seat at the table in the federal climate policy debate. Finally, just let me say that it's clear that the cost of carbon tremendously affects the cost of power from new coal plants. This is from testimony in the Big Stone 2 case in South Dakota that shows what the impact of low, mid, and high carbon cost assumptions do to the price of coal power compared to a mix of wind and natural gas combined cycle technology with and without a renewable energy production tax credit. And you can see even at the low carbon price, which is much lower than prices have recently been in Europe, for example, it makes that power uncompetitive with the wind and coal mix. So the recommendation there is don't dig a deeper hole by building new coal in new unconstrained coal without some method of capturing and storing the carbon. The European PUC has already recognized that risk, so I think you're showing some leadership there. It's imprudent to build big new emission sources because, as I said, controls on carbon pollution clearly are coming down the pike. You don't want to create another generation of stranded investments like we experienced in the 1980s and 90s with nuclear power that have to be passed through to ratepayers in some way. And I think your bill takes a sensible approach here by prohibiting increased emissions from new power plants as you're moving forward to implement your plan. So let me just stop there. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Dr. Meyer. Thank you for coming all the way from Washington. And are there any questions for Dr. Meyer before we proceed? Okay. Thank you again, Dr. Meyer. And next, if we have Ms. Molly Schultz. Thank you, Ms. Schultz, and if you state your name for the tape, please.
Thank you, Chairman Eakin, representatives. My name is Molly Schultz, and I'm the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. And as many of you know, MEP supports the Global Warming Mitigation Act, and we're working closely with our member organizations and on this and other legislation this session. But I'm here today to talk about why we're supporting this bill. MEP is a coalition of 80 environmental and conservation organizations throughout Minnesota, so our members are other member groups. They include some of the groups here today, Fresh Energy, Clean Water Action, the Isaac Walton League, Sierra Club. Together, these 80 organizations represent 450,000 Minnesotans. Each year, MEP selects a few legislative issues that are part of the collective agenda. It means that the full force of our member groups works towards their passage. And this year, we overwhelmingly heard from our members that global warming must be a top priority for MEP. And I know you'll be hearing a lot today about the need for Minnesota to slow down and wait for federal action, but I can tell you that that sentiment is not shared by the Minnesotans represented by our member groups. And even Minnesotans who don't necessarily belong to member groups, but have been showing up at our town hall forums, our citizen events, and our in-district meetings. These people are talking to us about the need for Minnesota to do its part to solve this problem. And just to give you an idea of some of the events that have been hosted throughout the state, we've had some unprecedented turnout. We've had some forums in Winona that drew 800 people. We had a forum in Bemidji that drew 350 people, an event in Wilmer that drew 450 people, Brainerd, 450 people, Woodbury, 650 people, and Eden Prairie, 1,000 people turned out for an event to learn more about global warming. So this is definitely something that Minnesotans from all walks of life are very concerned about. And the reason is that they are looking around and they see that something's wrong. And we have a lot of data to show that that things are wrong, but just everyday people are seeing some changes. And in a report given by Dr. Don Piera at this year's DNR Roundtable, he illustrated some massive changes that our members, our hunters, our anglers, our wildlife watchers are already seeing, and some grim predictions for the future. In addition to wetlands being lost to development, Minnesota is also losing wetlands as a result of the state becoming drier. As our temperature increases, the water is becoming warmer, and the cold water systems will no longer be able to support fish like trout, walleye, and northern. Dr. Piera reported that in 50 years, there will likely not be trout streams in southern Minnesota. And so when our members see things like that and hear things like that, they become very concerned. We're also at risk of losing our northern forests, and that is of grave concern to Minnesotans. And as we heard here already by Dr. Meyer, as our summers become more like Kansas and our winters become more like Illinois, we're going to see some pretty massive shifts in wildlife and habitat. And I can tell you from driving around the state and talking to people and attending some of these meetings that this issue, this global warming issue, touches people in a way that we have not seen before. We're used to seeing a lot of passion from people about environment and conservation. People feel very passionately about wildlife preservation, about clean air, about clean water. It's something that they care very deeply about. But what we're not used to seeing is sort of a fear from people that we're at a tipping point. This is beyond, I think, just a concern. People are really genuinely afraid that Minnesota is teetering dangerously close to a tipping point, and they don't really. They're concerned that the elected officials aren't acting quickly enough. So, as you can see, the message from our members is loud and clear. Do something, do it now, don't wait any longer. That's why the Minnesota Environmental Partnership is supporting the Global Warming Mitigation Act and why we're working closely with our member organizations to pass it. So, I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Schultz. Any questions for Ms. Schultz at all? Okay, thanks again. And next we have Reverend Mark Peters. I'm the Executive Director of the Lutheran Coalition for Public Policy.
Thank you,
Reverend, for joining us, and if you could state your name for the tape, please.
Pleasure to be here with you today. I'm Mark Peters. I'm Executive Director of Lutheran Coalition for Public Policy in Minnesota. I've been doing this work for about 11 years, but even before that, when I was after I finished seminary at Luther Seminary in St. Paul, I spent a year interning with the Minnesota Interfaith Ecology Coalition, so I've seen this growth over the years to where we are right now in addressing these concerns that we're talking about today, and that's what I'd like to speak with today. Lutheran Coalition for Public Policy is a partnership ministry of the six Minnesota synods of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, about 1,200 congregations, about 800,000 Lutherans. As I like to say, Lutherans are pretty dense in Minnesota. Global warming is a religious and a moral issue, and the U.S. makes only about 4% of the world's population but contributes 25% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. That's astounding. This statistic is especially important because global warming is already having a disproportionate negative impact on those least able to do anything about it. We are called to care for all of God's children, especially the most vulnerable, and we have a unique role to play to protect and restore God's creation. I testified last year in the House and in the Senate regarding mercury. Minnesota chose to become a leader in the nation in continuing down the path towards cleaner energy then. This year again, I testified in the Senate about the renewable electricity standard, and again, Minnesota took another step forward, historic step forward, again setting a national standard to be a leader in clean energy. We are on the right path, and we need to keep walking that path. Lutheran congregations have been stepping up their efforts to learn about and address global warming, thinking globally and acting locally. Let me just share a few examples. Our office, which is thankfully right across the street so I could walk over here at Christ Lutheran Church, I don't know how I'll get home, but I'm sure you're all wondering about that yourself. But the volume of phone calls, emails, correspondence to our office, even though we work on hunger and poverty, health care, a broad array of issues, I'd say about 50% of our phone calls to our office, those correspondents, are now about global warming and congregations forming creation care teams, global warming action teams, you name it. They are very busy out there. Let me give you a few examples here. In the 12 months between November 2005 and November 2006, an interfaith initiative that we helped start called Congregations Caring for Creation has co-sponsored 17 Eyewitness to Global Warming events with Polar Explorer Will Steger. You got a good glimpse of that at the Capitol recently at that historic event. Nine of those were in ELCA congregations, and they averaged over, well, the overall attendance was close to 8,000 people. Examples of where and how many, just a few, because time is short. 1,000 in November of 2006 at St. Andrew's Lutheran Church in Matamidak. 1,000 April 2006 at St. Andrew Lutheran Church in Eden Prairie. 460 gathered at Bethel Lutheran Church in Northfield. They had overflow to another room with a monitor in a congregation that hosts 350 people. This is the type of turnout we are experiencing when we just set the table for these types of conversations. The Metro Lutheran just got it in the mail today as a lead story on Minneapolis Area Synod Bishop Craig Johnson, who told lawmakers in this joint hearing, this historic hearing recently, many of you were probably there, he said, "I plead with you to begin this year to boldly step forward with continued scientific research, development of new clean technologies in power generation and transportation, an energy economy dependent, less dependent on fossil fuels and targets and timetables for reductions of greenhouse gas emissions." He goes to conclude, "We as a mighty and affluent nation have a moral obligation to help to protect the poor," and then he concludes, "long journeys begin with a first step." The Global Warming Mitigation Act takes realistic and reasonable first steps to set limits on global warming pollution. The core values of my faith tradition, shared by many other faith traditions, calls for an imaginative and creative and urgent response to the crisis of global warming. Caring for our neighbor, one of those core themes. And who is my neighbor? Well, those downwind and around the world from our admissions are also our neighbor. To be a faithful steward of God's creation on behalf of that neighbor calls for bold action that is more than good intentions and promises to study the issue. Measurable actions must follow words, or they simply perpetuate inaction and hold no one to accountability. There is a cost to future generations if we do not act. And lastly, I think of my two boys, their ages 2 and 6. I told them I'd be late home to work tonight because of this hearing, and they know what I'm talking about because, well, they're enjoying the snow right now. But in regards to this issue, if I talk to them and my words to them are void of action, then I will quickly lose their attention, and they won't change their behavior in any way that I'm trying to seek to guide that behavior. The question today is, will we act or be seen by our kids and our grandkids, those dependent on our actions, our neighbors around the world, as sitting by the wayside waiting for absolute certainty, someone else to lead? I always thought Minnesota was the leader. I like to see them as that. And a neat yellow brick road to follow. Your decisions on this issue will impact future generations, and I urge you to keep them in mind when you vote. And finally, I got a quote from Abraham Lincoln that came into my email today, and I'd like to share it with you that I think speaks to this. "Let us have faith that right makes might, and in that faith dare to do our duty." Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much.
Thank you, Reverend Peters. Any questions at all? Thank you again. And next on the list, we have Mr. Douglas Pierce.
give out some handouts.
That'd be fine. Yes, if you want to, if a page could pass those out. And welcome, Mr. Pierce. If you could state your name, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, representatives, for the opportunity to be here. My name is Douglas Pierce. I'm a practicing architect with the firm of Perkins & Will in Minneapolis. I'm here today representing the 2,000 members of the American Institute of Architects Minnesota. We are a chapter of AIA National, which has over 78,000 members across the U.S., and I'm proud to say that AIA is celebrating its 150th anniversary this year. Buildings, both commercial and residential, are responsible for approximately 48% of all greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S. 30% of that comes from burning fossil fuels to operate buildings. 18% comes from manufacturing the materials to construct them, construction operations, and the long-term maintenance of buildings. Buildings consume approximately 76% of all of the electricity produced in the U.S. Dramatically reducing the carbon footprint of buildings is essential to mitigating the impacts of global warming. AIA Minnesota fully supports the Global Warming Mitigation Act, and its benchmarks are in keeping with the AIA national goals for carbon reduction. In 2004, AIA Minnesota adopted a position statement on global warming calling for an 80% economy-wide reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. More recently, AIA National has embraced similar goals with the 2030 Challenge. The 2030 Challenge sets benchmarks for reducing the carbon emissions of new and remodeled buildings. Our goals are a 60% reduction in carbon emissions attributable to buildings starting in 2010, a 70% reduction starting in 2015, an 80% reduction in 2020, 90% in 2025, and carbon neutral starting in 2030. The U.S. Conference of Mayors adopted the 2030 Challenge benchmarks as part of Resolution 50 in June of 2006. We foresee achieving these reductions through a combination of energy, building energy efficiency, on-site renewable power, grid-sourced renewable energy, biofuels, and hydrogen. Meeting these goals will also require building materials that are manufactured and transported with renewable energy, along with construction equipment that uses renewable, low-carbon fuel. Energy efficiency is the backbone of this strategy, and we believe it holds significant promise. As a rule, it costs about one-third as much to conserve energy as it costs to produce it. Conserving energy is fiscally responsible and economically positive. To illustrate this point, I have a few examples of energy-efficient buildings constructed recently in Minnesota. The University of Minnesota's McGuire Translational Research is a 95,000-square-foot laboratory that's designed to operate 43% better than the Minnesota Building Code. That offers a 40-year savings in CO2 of 117,400 tons, and it will save $10.5 million in operating costs with a 2.8-year payback. The Winona State New Science Building, it's a 149,000-square-foot lab. Total energy is 42% better than code, with a 40-year savings of 72,000 tons of CO2, $6.5 million in operating costs, with a payback of 1.5 years for the energy efficiency features. The Wilder Center, which is under construction in St. Paul right now, it's a 100,000-square-foot office building. Total energy, 45% better than code, with a 40-year savings of 28,000 tons of CO2, $2.8 million savings in operating costs with a 5.4-year payback. And I'd like to say the operating costs are not escalated. These are in today's dollars. A recent office retrofit in Minneapolis was 250,000-square-foot office building. Total energy, 42% better than code, 65,000 tons of CO2 saved, $5.9 million saved, 3.8-year payback. And we currently have a corporate office building on the boards that we expect to be 60% better than code with a 7.5-year payback. As a profession, we have started dealing with global warming, and we are preparing to help lead our sector of the economy towards significant carbon reductions, but we cannot do it alone. In order to make our buildings energy efficient and carbon neutral, we will need the participation of equipment manufacturers, the electronics industry, the building material sector, real estate brokers, lenders, the trades, the transportation sector, utilities, the software industry, and many others. Ultimately, building owners need to request carbon neutrality, and society needs to expect it. As a profession, we take our colleagues in the science community very seriously when they tell us that we must deal with the issue of global warming promptly. We trust their expertise, and we intend to respond as part of our ethical commitment to the health, safety, and welfare of the public. We are hopeful about our civilization's future and believe strongly in the creative capacity of both our country and humankind. This effort, the effort to literally save our civilization, will require an extended response by every market sector. With a common mission, market guidance, measurable goals, and accountability, we can collectively solve this problem, and we can create a better, healthier, and more stable world along the way. AIA Minnesota is in full support of the reduction goals and timelines of the Global Warming Mitigation Act. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Pierce. Any questions at all? Representative Finkelstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Pierce, I appreciate the handout here. I know I've been looking at some of these issues as it relates to our state buildings and our capital investment projects. The examples that you've cited here are all more than 40% better than code, and I know right now in state statute we only require our state buildings to be 30% better than code. I mean, how realistic are these numbers that you have here, and should we be looking at some higher guidelines for our state buildings?
Ms. Deegers. The 40% is realistic as long as the buildings are, the desire to have energy efficiency is taken into account from the very beginning of the process. That requires budgeting for it. There is some additional cost. It requires planning for it to start with. Now, each different types of buildings have different possibilities. The two buildings that were shown in this presentation were laboratory buildings. They're very energy intensive, it's very cost effective to reduce their energy efficiency. The two other buildings that we looked, that we showed, the Wilder Center, which is an office building, it's at 45% better. That was done with fairly straightforward mechanical equipment, but it's harder to get energy efficiency out of an office building because they don't consume as much energy. So I think it should be taken should look closely at the building types with current technology.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah.
Any other questions? Thanks again, Mr. Pierce. Next, we have Ms. Michelle Hesterberg. Thanks for joining us, Ms. Hesterberg, and if you could state your name, please, for the tape.
My name is Michelle Hesterberg, and I'm a high school senior at Mount Park Academy on the border of St. Paul and Maplewood, and I'm 17 years old. As a child, my parents took me, my brother, and my sister to countless state parks for family vacations. These trips and my dad's love of the outdoors instilled in me a passion for nature that led me to donate part of my allowance to the World Wildlife Fund to help protect the wilderness. My enthusiasm for camping and my connection to the wilderness has increased as I have grown up. A few years ago, I began taking wilderness trips through YMCA Camp Minogen to the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. For 3 years now, I have spent a few weeks of my summer paddling through the Boundary Waters in northern Minnesota. This summer, I will spend at least 30 days paddling a river in the Canadian wilderness. These trips have become the most important part of my life, helping me grow as a person, develop leadership skills, discover who I am, and increase my confidence. For a public policy class, my partner and I are working to establish a program to help under-resourced but high-potential youth from Breakthrough St. Paul, an academic enrichment program for St. Paul Public Middle School students, go to the wilderness. 10 youth from Breakthrough will go to Minogen this summer. Although Minoja and Breakthrough St. Paul have agreed to supply most of the money, we are now working to raise the remaining $1,500. We are also planning to make the program sustainable for the future. I have discovered in doing this project that barriers for people to experience the wonder of the wilderness can be overcome. However, the degradation of the wilderness will present insurmountable obstacles. As a dedicated camper and wilderness enthusiast, I do not want to imagine a world in which future generations will not have the opportunities to experience the Minnesota that I have come to know. It is scary to see the effects of global warming. I have now had my driver's license for 1.5 years, and I have never driven in as much snow as we have had this week. When I was little, I remember sledding and playing in this much snow for several months each winter. My younger sister, Ariana, who is now 12 years old, does not even remember the last time we had this much snow on the ground. Perhaps our lack of snow in the last 2 years is the consequence of normal weather variations. However, considering that scientists agree that global warming is occurring, it is certainly possible that we are already seeing the effects of it. Currently, young people's health is being compromised by air pollution from pulverized coal plants and other sources. For example, asthma rates are high, and scientists expect asthma and other health problems will get worse with global warming. Supporting a strong action plan to reduce global warming pollution by 80% will be a huge help. Considering the drastic effects of global warming and other pollutants, it is important that we take action now. The longer we wait, the more detrimental the effects of global warming will be, making it harder and more expensive to fix. Eventually, we will reach a point of no return when we cannot fix the damage we have done to the environment. If that happens, the Boundary Waters will certainly not be the same because of the changes to the climate and ecosystem. It is possible that I will only have stories to tell my children or my grandchildren about what it was like for me to paddle through the Boundary Waters, breathe clean air, drink fresh lake water, and enjoy the beauty of the untouched wilderness. I will have to be content that I have done my part in helping people to experience the wilderness by sending Breakthrough St. Paul students to the Boundary Waters. In 2050, the target date for deep reduction, I will be 61 years old. It is my generation that will be living under the policies that you create and the environmental improvements they'll bring. It is my children that will be growing up under these policies. Please particularly consider the interests of my generation in whatever plan you come up with. If we take action now, and there are deep reductions by 2050, my generation and my children's generation will have a chance to enjoy the same opportunities that you had and I have had to experience the wilderness. I sincerely hope that I will be able to visit Minnesota's amazingly beautiful state and federal parks with my children, as my parents did with me. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Hesterberg, and excellent job. I'm always very impressed to see young people like yourself getting engaged and involved in the process. I hope other young people follow your lead. Are there any questions at all for Ms. Hesterberg? Thanks again.
Thank you.
Next, Ms. Lindsay Dahl.
Thank you. That's a
tough
one to follow.
If you could state your name for the record, tape, please.
Yes. My name is Lindsay Dahl, and I'm the public policy advocate for the Minnesota Public Interest Research Group. Founded by students in 1971, MPIRG is a student-directed, nonpartisan organization that empowers and trains students and engages the community to take collective action in the public interest. We are the largest organization in the state that works with students to increase their effectiveness in the public policy arena. I am here representing college students from the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, U of M Morris, U of M Duluth, Hamline, Augsburg, the College of St. Catharines, McAllister College, Carleton College, and the William Mitchell College of Law. I am here today to create a context for you, a context in which you are viewing the Global Warming Mitigation Act. As important bills like these come into the legislature, I understand that you are put under tremendous pressure from various stakeholders. But as we talk about global warming, I'm here to remind you that I am representing the largest stakeholders of all, Minnesota's youth. The science has shown us what will happen if Minnesota is doing business as usual. the bleak picture of a changed Minnesota is not the environment I envision raising my children. That's why passing the bill needs to happen this year. Some may say the bill is too much and too fast. MPRG students respectfully disagree, because when it comes to their future, addressing global warming can never come too fast. A normal part of our daily lives constitutes making wise investments. Some of us choose carefully as we invest in the stock market. Others buy homes or prime pieces of property. College students carefully decide their majors. And businesses look for long-term planning to ensure long-term success. Today I'm going to ask you to make another wise investment, an investment in Minnesota's youth. By passing the Global Warming Mitigation Act, you can take an important step for protecting our future environment and health. When today's students are adults and you have children, we hope to share the northern boreal forest with them, safely fish from our lakes and rivers, and enjoy hunting the large waterfowl populations in western Minnesota. In addition, passing this bill is important for directing Minnesota's economy towards the new business opportunities of the future. Normally, high school students and college students aren't thinking about what the economy is going to look like when they're 30, 40, or 50 years old. For the first time, college students are asking those questions. They are wondering what global warming could do to their future economy. Minnesota's economy is based primarily on natural resources, whether it be tourism related to snowmobiling, skiing, cross-country skiing, or even the agriculture sector. Future generations depend on those economies to make Minnesota the economically vibrant place it is today. By passing the global warming bill this year, Minnesota will have the first mover advantage. In other words, we will become the heartland leader in the low-carbon economy. On behalf of the MPRG students, I want to thank you for passing the renewable electricity standard. It is now time for the next step, passing House File 375. Global warming cannot be actively addressed without setting immediate goals to make deep reductions in Minnesota's global warming pollution. We have waited long enough. As you think about this bill and you discuss it with your colleagues, I ask you to remember my face, one face representing thousands of youth across the state. Know that you have the support of Minnesota's youth, and we are all asking you to please make a wise planning investment for our future. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dahl. Any questions at all for Ms. Dahl? Well said. Thanks again. Next on the list, we have I'm sure I pronounced this right. Mr. Wadalevich.
Correct.
Yes. Thank you for joining us. If you could state your name, please.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Brian Wadalevich. I am a lawyer from Appleton, Minnesota, a small village due west of here, just 20 miles from the South Dakota border. I'm the immediate past chair of an organization called Clean Up the River Environment, which is 400 individuals and families who live in the Upper Minnesota Valley River, River Valley watershed. And I have heard that this law, if it's passed, might interfere with or even stop the construction of the new proposed Big Stone 2 power plant. And I'm here to say, as a customer of Big Stone 2 of Otter Tail, both in my home and in my small business, I would love nothing more than to have that plant stopped in its construction. For 30 years, they have dumped mercury poison on me, my family, my neighbors. They have spewed carbon dioxide out in the atmosphere. We had hearings recently out in western Minnesota, and what we learned from those hearings is that even when this new plant is built that they're proposing, initially for maybe up to 3 years, they'll be spewing even more mercury poison out on us. But even after it's supposed to be running all up to Hoyle, they say the mercury poison is going to be the same level that they have been spewing. Now, we do not want that. Pure and simple. All of our lakes and rivers in western Minnesota, all the significant ones, are already shown to be too high in mercury poisoning. Now, this new plant also will spew, from what I understood in the hearings, 4.7 million metric tons of carbon dioxide. That's more CO2 than all the vehicles in South Dakota are spewing out. Now, mind you, this plant is just over the border in South Dakota. Why? Why did they go over there and build it? Otter Tail Power and these other folks. I think you know the answer. Now, as a customer of Otter Tail, I'm here also to complain about the higher rates we're going to get hit with this. I mean, not only are they going to ask us to pay for this $2 billion new plant, spewing this out, there's also higher railroad costs that they know are going to come. They unsuccessfully fought in D.C. against the railroads. They're having trouble with them already. So we're going to have higher costs there that we, the ratepayers, are going to pay. And then there's going to be the additional federal fees and taxes that we know eventually the American society is going to come to its senses and start putting on carbon. We, the ratepayers of Otter Tail, are going to pay for that bill, too. But the last thing I want to talk to you about is something almost completely different. It's not the carbon. It's not the mercury poison, as if they aren't bad enough. This is the Natural Resources and Environment Committee. We found out that in this new plant, they're going to be taking 3.2 billion gallons of water each year, more water, out of Big Stone Lake, one of our border lakes. And as far as we know, no one came and asked us, the people of Minnesota, would you like that? Is that okay with you? I don't know that they came to the Minnesota government. Nothing that I'm aware of says that. And we're already learning from scientists and other folks that water is going to be the next big oil crisis. So I think that should be looked into. And why is this happening without any of our say-so, as far as I've heard? 3.2 billion gallons out of one of our border lakes, our boundary water lakes. Thank you for your time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Wadalevich. And are there any questions at all? And thanks again. Next, we have a Mr. Jack Rosbach, or Rosbach? Okay. Thank you. Could state your name, please.
Yeah. Good afternoon. I'm Jack Rosbach. I'm from St. Paul. It was interesting. I was part of the students that voted for the Minnesota Public Interest Research Group when it was first formed in 1971. I was a senior at the University of Minnesota studying chemistry, so it's nice to see that continuity there. I'm a father. I have two children, and in the late 1970s, I was a great fan of Buckminster Fuller's, who was convinced that we were suffering global warming then, and so it's kind of been a 30-year process for me. I've made some dramatic changes in my life at that time, and then I again made some rather dramatic changes in 1992 where I decided I would try to see if I could reduce my output of global warming gases by approximately 95%, and I was extremely successful. So just to let people know that this proposal, this Global Warming Mitigation Act, is very reachable. What I prefer to think about, though, because I'm a grassroots activist, is how we can include all the people into this process. I did some calculations at one time, and I discovered that if we take the total GDP of the country of the United States and the total pounds of global warming carbon dioxide equivalent gases, we get that each dollar of GDP expenditure is equivalent to 1 pound of carbon dioxide released into the atmosphere. And that becomes a very, very interesting number because it's accessible to all people to evaluate what they're doing. For example, and I know this isn't exactly correct because the state expenditures aren't all GDP expenditures, but the two-year biennial budget proposal of the governor is $55 billion, which would be 55 billion pounds of carbon dioxide to be released in the atmosphere. The one I prefer that affects us in St. Paul is that the building of the light rail is $1 billion approximately, and that means 1 billion pounds of carbon dioxide will be released in the air before the project, before the first person even rides on the first train there. So those are considerations that I think that people should make. I did a brief little calculation because there's this ongoing discussion about Al Gore's energy use, which is 221,000 kilowatt hours of electric use, and I compared it to my own, which is approximately 4,000 kilowatt hours. He beats me 55-1, and I want to do cap and trade with him. I think that's a good idea for me on that side. So, the cap and trade is an absolute beautiful system. I believe it can work. I've been following the Chicago Climate Exchange model. But I think that there's an energy conservation and a monetary conservation model that could be even faster and more efficient. And the example I'll give you works in the Twin City area. 3 years ago, I attended a transportation conference, and I was giving the travel time inventory, and I looked at it, and it was exactly the same as the travel time inventory was 20 years prior. The rush hour peaks had expanded, and what happened was people became so much more efficient at their traveling that even though there was a great deal more traffic, they still were managed to get from one place to the other in the same time period, and this is over a 20-year period. So I think this ability within our society is absolutely marvelous. I don't know if people remember the in San Francisco, they had the huge water shortage there. That's where shower with a friend, that phrase was born. But they managed to reduce, I think, around 90% of their water use. And so I recommend that there be some sort of component to this where we can include all the people at a grassroots level in the functioning. And I think people understanding $1, 1 pound of carbon dioxide would greatly help. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Rosbach. Any questions? Thanks again. next, we have a Mr. Dell Erickson. Mr. Dell Erickson. Okay. Next on the list, Mr. Edward Garvey, Deputy Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Commerce. If you could come forward, please. Thank you very much for joining us. I understand the governor gave state agency officials the rest of the day off, so I appreciate you coming here today.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Edward Garvey, Deputy Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Commerce, and I assure you that we are 24/7 public service. You know, where we are is still serving the public, man.
Well, you're proof of that, so thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm going to address you as a Department of Commerce representative, but I'm also addressing you on behalf of the Governor Pawlenty's administration. I'm also going to, as part of my presentation, I'm going to address Governor Pawlenty's approach to this very important issue that's before you and that Representative Rood's Bill House File 375 is certainly a very good step in that direction, and the amendments make that a positive step even more. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, climate change is a real threat, raising very important long-range public policy issues to Minnesota. The concentration of atmospheric CO2 is increasing. Credible scientific evidence links the increased CO2 concentrations to human activity. This increase is likely to change and may already be changing the world's climate, posing a significant threat to Minnesota, the United States, and the global community. Governor Pawlenty believes it is in Minnesota's best interest to develop comprehensive, responsible, deliberative, and enduring ways to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. Article 5 of House File 436 would do that. That is a bill that's been authored by Chairman Hilty. It is part of the Governor's Next Generation Energy Initiative. Before briefly talking about those specific sections and ideas, I'd like to explain to the committee the thinking that went into those provisions and how they may be different from House File 375, as I understand it. While we believe climate change is real, we recognize that there are uncertainties. How much will climate change? How fast could that change occur? What will be the impact of that change? Can we see that change today? And what does it all mean for Minnesota? Our key questions. As we crafted the administration's approach, we recognize that Minnesota did not create this problem, nor can we solve it by ourselves unilaterally. Climate change is a global problem requiring global and national solutions. Although Minnesota can and should address its contribution, it should not do it in ways that unfairly disadvantage our citizenry or our industries. Similarly, we recognize that this problem cannot be solved overnight and believe it is counterproductive to try. We need to make sure we do the right things for the right reasons in the right ways. And we also make sure that today's solutions do not become tomorrow's problems. There are many positive ways to address climate change. For example, our tentative analysis of the recently enacted, signed into law last year, 25 by 25 renewables law, one of the most aggressive, most thoughtful renewables policies in the state, in the country, has the effect of potentially stabilizing the carbon emissions from our electricity sector. That's the tentative conclusion of my staff and needs to be double-checked with the Pollution Control Agency. Assuming that that's true, that is a very, very significant achievement in and of itself, and one that we need to keep in mind as we move forward. Improving the state's energy efficiency efforts, as suggested by Governor Pawlenty in the Next Generation Energy Initiative legislation of House File 436, will only go further in that direction. Additional climate change solutions, which we're discussing here this afternoon, need to be creative, beyond government thinking. To paraphrase Albert Einstein, we cannot solve today's problems with yesterday's thinking. It will take new and different ways of doing things to address climate change. This requires a deliberative, bottom-up approach. Such an approach is reinforced by the fact that everyone contributes to the problem, so everyone must be made part of the solution. Accordingly, an inclusive process that assures that all interested people, industries, and economic sectors can and do participate is needed to come up with those creative and comprehensive ways to reduce Minnesota's greenhouse gas emissions. Such a stakeholder process is the cornerstone of Governor Pawlenty's less carbon approach. Not only do we seek more renewables and more efficiency, but we do seek less carbon, Mr. Chairman. Although this effort is already underway, as you've heard from Representative Root and others, we are asking that it be codified in Section 4 of Article 5 of House File 436. I certainly understand that that bill is not before this committee, but I do want to bring those points to the committee's attention, and they are, to a certain extent, already included in the provisions of House File 375, and I believe the delete all amendment that, at least the draft that I saw, goes a little bit further. For that, we're grateful, because we do believe that that should be the cornerstone of the policies that this state takes to address carbon. There are other sections that the governor suggests that we take. You've already heard that we do believe that our new fossil fuel generating facilities that would be proposed and permitted for the state of Minnesota that would provide retail load do offset the additional greenhouse gas emissions before getting a certificate of need from the Public Utilities Commission. Under the legislation that Governor Pawlenty has proposed, those offsets can be achieved by capturing and then sequestering of the facility's carbon emissions, the purchase or greenhouse gas credits, or by some other offset mechanisms approved by the Public Utilities Commission. Governor Pawlenty has also made very clear that the state of Minnesota, as an operating entity, has a role in addressing this issue. We contribute and we take responsibility for those contributions and should take steps to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. We are currently gathering our data so that we understand what those emissions are and evaluate the merits of joining an exchange such as the Chicago Climate Exchange. A fourth component of Governor Pawlenty's Next Generation Energy Initiative on the less carbon category is to work with our neighboring states to collectively reduce our emissions. We have already started to work with our neighbors to work with on registry issues and data collection. We will also be talking with them about a carbon trading kind of arrangement. To conclude, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, climate change is a real threat posing difficult public policy choices. Minnesota can and should address its CO2 emissions, and Governor Pawlenty has offered a comprehensive, responsible, deliberative, and enduring way of doing this. Mr. Chairman, I look forward to working with you, members of this committee, and certainly Representative Ruth in addressing her bill and the best ways to address carbon emissions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I sit ready for any questions you or the committee may have.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner Garvey. And yes, Representative Breinhardt has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Garvey, I would like you to specifically cite what is it about House Bill 275 that you feel doesn't do all of the things that you have said are necessary for Minnesota's future in terms of addressing CO2 reduction.
Commissioner Garvey.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Reiner. To answer that question, I'm at a little bit of a disadvantage because I have not had the time to completely review the new delete all that I believe has been offered. And I believe that there have been sort of important, significant changes in that delete all from the original House Bill 375 that I think goes in a way that, in a direction that makes it more acceptable to me. The issue that we're most critically talking about, though, is how we do it and how fast we make the carbon emissions. I mean, those become the two critical questions. The movement, as I understood from Representative Rood, that the cap and trade issue has been moved from a requirement into the stakeholder planning process. I think that's a very positive step. Another specific question is that on the offsets from our fossil fuel. The governor's approach is a more flexible approach. It would allow us to make more immediate determinations based upon current situations and current technologies and current understandings and current trading mechanisms that I think is specifically addressed. And those are issues that I think we can work on in the coming days on this bill.
Representative Breiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would be interested, after you have reviewed the delete all amendment, of a more specific response, because I'm very concerned about the issues you raise about moving too fast, especially in light of all the testimony we've heard today. It seems to me that the indications are we've been moving much too slowly. So I would be interested in a more specific response at some time in the future.
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I don't serve on the Energy Committee. I never have. And so I'm just going to give you a question. It may sound real dumb. If the Big Stone plan isn't built, how will the electricity from all of the... I understand that they have a certificate of need or are near getting one for a power line to carry that type of electricity into the market. How will the electricity... As well, it will carry electricity from future renewable projects. If they don't have that power line, and they can't build the plant, so then they don't build the power line, or the power line doesn't get built, how do we get that renewable energy into market if there isn't a current transmission for it? Can we get it here?
Commissioner Garvey.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative, that is a very, very important question.
It is?
A very important question.
Can you tell my local papers I asked something that was good?
That answering that question requires a number of assumptions and alternatives and scenarios. There's no perfect certain answer. But it does drive to the point that as we address these kinds of issues, we need to be flexible and understanding of the ramifications both in the near term and the long term.
And, Representative Borghini has a question as well.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
I want to follow up on the question about moving too fast, because that too is concerning to me that you would say that. One of the things that was handed out, and I suspect you've seen it, is this chart. And it looks, I look at all of these other states and what they have done, and they have targets. And just looking at the top one, Arizona, 2000 levels by 2020, 50% below 2000 levels by 2040. Do you think that's too fast?
Commissioner Garvey.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Bouguenais. The question of speed, in my opinion, isn't one that should be decided by me, but needs to be decided by a stakeholder process of informed cross-section of Minnesotans. And that they need to be informed and understanding what they're doing, what they can do, how they would do that, and from that you achieve your goals and your targets and you implement a plan. When I say speed, I'm saying this is a bottom-up perspective, not the top-down. And that waiting the year to allow the stakeholders to sort through these kinds of things to make sure we get a plan that is aggressive, but doable and achievable, and accepted by all people, and implemented by all people, was the one that will endure. It's not necessarily a goal issue. It's how we do the goal.
Representative Lagunias.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things that happened to me when I was door knocking this year, and I do that even though I'm a long-term legislator, I door knocked my district. And global warming just popped up as an issue. But I thought it was just my district where that happened. But then when we came together in January and we were talking with our colleagues, I was hearing that that was happening all over the state. And that's, of course, why we've seen so much activity this year. So we're the ones that represent the grassroots. Do you think it's better to have someone else other than the representatives of the people make the decisions for the target?
Commissioner Garvey.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Lagunias. Our view is that I'm a relatively informed person on these issues. You're a very well-informed person on this issue. Members on this committee are also very well-informed. We can pick a number, our goal and a target date. But until we sort of thought through and analyzed and spent a lot of time looking at the data and putting together a plan and understanding what action steps we would take, it would just be a number that we picked because of our basic personal knowledge. What I'm saying is that that's the data that you want. And it's not the goal per se, it's the process of learning what that goal should be and the steps that you want to take that are the really important process. And that's what we're trying to put into place.
Yeah. Representative Mariani had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Deputy Commissioner. I guess it's a little bit following up on Representative Bill's I've not seen the House File 436, but in the delete all amendment we have under Section 5, the import or commit to import provision, and so that speaks obviously a bit to the the plans in South Dakota. Has the governor taken a position or identified, taken a position, I suppose, in terms of his approach to outside of the state generators of power, in terms of what this state's position or posture should be relative to that generation of power's contribution to carbon emissions?
Commissioner Garvey.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Mahan, the governor's position is that new fossil fuel generated facilities that will serve retail load in the state of Minnesota should offset the carbon emissions, regardless of where they are located. And we have so indicated to the facilities that would be proposed to do so.
And Mr. Chair, and the operative words there are inside the state of Minnesota. No?
No.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Regardless of where they're located.
All right, thank you.
It's a retail load question.
All right, thank you. Thank you for the clarification. And Mr. Chair and members, just very quickly, a little bit on Representative Wagenius. It seems to me that, you know, we are at a major crossroads here, and I think that even if you look at what's happened the last year in this body, whether it's the Renewable Energies Initiative or even last year with the mercury reduction, it's not an energy load issue, but related issues in terms of how we generate our energy and the impact on society. I think that there is, I'll put out that I think there is a huge sea change that's happening across our society. And I think that if you look at the political activity in the fall in the last elections, I think those issues were very much in the forefront of many of our constituents. And so I think that there is a politically, there is a time here for us to be bold, just from a political point of view. Let me just say also that I think the timetables, and I'm not familiar with Representative Root's language entirely, but I'm looking at those timetables, 15% by 2015, 30% by 25, 80% by 50. It seems to me that part of what's happening or what's being suggested here is precisely to buy ourselves some time to be able to think through these issues, but at the same time be able to act. And I think part of that involves being able to influence mid- to long-term investment decisions that, if we're not trying to influence now, may determine these issues apart from the public's ability to influence those. So I just wanted to put that out there, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Garvey, on the stakeholder group issue, you know, I think there is value to having people who have knowledge of how to make things work sort of fill in the, or flesh out the idea. But before coming to the legislature, I've been in stakeholder groups, advisory groups, task forces, and whatnot. Sometimes it's just like the fox is running the hen house. I guess I'd like to know what the scope of the stakeholder group might be in the governor's view.
Commissioner Garvey.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, representative. The stakeholder group that the governor is in the process of putting together will the number of members will be still to be determined, but it'll be in the range of the high 30s. It will represent a cross section of Minnesotans, from utilities to environmental advocates to large industrials to citizen experts to academics to small business operators, from farmers to sports enthusiasts, resort owners to fleet operators. The goal is to put together a group of people who are experts in their perspective, thoughtful, deliberative people who would come together to develop a plan that would aggressively reduce Minnesota's carbon emissions and present that plan to this body, other legislative committees, and the governor by the end of this year.
Representative Gardner.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Garvey, one of the keys to success to these kinds of things tends to be the leadership and how well the process is facilitated. Otherwise, it has a hard time maintaining some cohesion and focus. Do you have any folks in mind who would lead that?
Commissioner Garvey.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for that opportunity to add to that. The governor has invited the Center for Climate Strategies to facilitate and run this stakeholder group. This is the group that has put together these plans in most of the states that you have in the colored map. California, New Mexico, Arizona, New York, Connecticut, other states they're also working. They're experts at putting together these kinds of plans. That's what they do. What our job is to give them the stakeholders, a cross-section of Minnesotans, that they can educate and work with and provide technical advice to them through a series of sub-technical committees to come up with a grassroots plan, work through the options, identify the costs and benefits, both economic and environmental, weigh them, and present them. It's the plan, as I understand it, is that Representative Rood's bill envisions that we would do herself.
I didn't realize that was going to be a softball question, but that's okay. Thank you.
Representative Dill had a question.
I think it could be Representative Virginius who got something to that point.
Representative Virginius. Yes.
Yes. I hear what you want to do, which is pull together a wide range of folks who are thoughtful and deliberate, and for them to come up with a plan. I can't disagree with that. But I can disagree with the notion that the legislature should not set the goal or the outcome. Our governor has told us again and again to have outcomes and to have rigor. He's told us this. I have listened to that. We should set an outcome or a target for this group. You're talking about sub-technical plans. That's super. That's not what the legislature should do. But we should set the overall policy for this state, because we do represent Minnesotans. Folks who are technical experts are wonderful, but they don't set the overall policy of the state.
Mr. Chairman,
Commissioner Garvey,
Representative Gaines. What I'm offering is a perspective. I'm not telling you that you can't, because I certainly can't. That wouldn't be my place. That's not my role. You certainly have the right. What I'm offering you is a reason why we did not put a goal in our legislation, is that we think that that goal should be established from the stakeholder process. If this committee, if the legislature, if you as elected officials wish to establish some goal and provide guidance to the stakeholder group, that certainly is your prerogative and role.
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In Section 5, on lines without my glasses here, it says on 27, 28, 29, it talks about no person shall construct within the state a new large facility that could contribute to power sector carbon dioxide emissions. Would that then preclude the construction of Excelsior Energy?
Commissioner Garvey.
Mr. Chair, Representative, which
says construct within the state a new large facility. In the delete all. It says construct within the state a new large facility that would contribute to statewide power sector carbon dioxide emissions. It says no person shall construct. It's on line 27, 28, and 29.
Page 5.
Page 5.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dill, I'm really not the best person to speak on the House File 375 or the delete all.
Are they,
Representative Dill?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I don't know technically, does that power plant increase carbon dioxide emissions as proposed?
Commissioner Garvey.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Dill. Yes, they do.
Well, unless the author could explain to me differently, that would be a clean coal technology that is prohibited by this bill also.
Representative Rood, did you want to respond?
Can you repeat your question for me so I don't know if you...
Repeat the question.
Representative Rood, on line 27 on page 5. And when you're there, let me shake your head. I'll go ahead. Okay, it says that no person shall, and then under 1, construct within the state a new large facility that would contribute to statewide power sector carbon dioxide emissions. So on the Iron Range, we have a proposed facility that would generate electricity to sell to a market that's a long way away. I think it's this area right here. And it would seem to me that if they're increasing their, if they, by building that plant, increase the emissions, that that plant would be no longer able to be built.
Unless they have offsets, that's correct.
And maybe a good question at this point would be how would the governor's plan differ? Is there a difference there, or is the governor's proposed legislation similar in that regard? Commissioner Garvey?
Mr. Chairman, the governor does have a policy of expecting offsets. The legislation itself that we propose would not apply to Excelsior because we make that facility, we make the legislation applicable to a certificate of need obligations. The Excelsior facility, Mesaba, is exempt from a certificate of need. So the legislation that the governor has proposed would not be explicitly applicable to Excelsior. Having said that, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the offset policy that the governor has proposed is his direction to me and a policy that we pursue. The question then becomes is, what is the expectation of those offsets? What is the nature of those offsets? Mm-hmm. And for that, we are more flexible than I sent a House File 375 is.
Thank you.
That's good enough. Thank you.
We have Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to point out the offset language that precedes the language that Representative Dill spoke to, but they've already covered that. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And Representative Breinhardt.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions at all? Okay, seeing none, thanks again, Commissioner Garvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Next on the list, we have Mr. Lauren Logtug.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Rood.
It was called to my attention. There's somebody in the room who could maybe give a better answer for Representative Dill, if that's okay.
Yeah, if they could step forward, that'd be great.
I'm not sure where he is. Bill, great.
All good questions.
Okay.
That's what I tell my local family. Is it what's wrong? Yeah.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. Thank you. You could state your name, please,
for the table. Bill Grant for the Isaac Walton League. I just wanted to point out to the committee's attention and to Representative Dill's question, the fact that on line 6.1 through 6.13, there is an exception for facilities that do offset their carbon emissions. So there are, and there are a couple of suggestions for how a power plant proposal like the Mesaba proposal could achieve offsets in sufficient degree to be able to go forward with their project, either by reducing the facility's contribution on their own, or by purchasing carbon dioxide allowances from a state or a group of states that have a cap and trade system that was generating credits in another part of the country. So it is at least in theory possible for a project like Mesaba to go forward under Representative Rood's bill.
Thank you, Mr. Grant. And we'll move on then. Mr. Logtag, if you'd state your name for the tape, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lauren Lotog. I'm here representing Watertail Power today. I should also note that since there were comments about Big Stone 2 previous to my testimony, Mr. Bob Schulte from the Big Stone 2 project is here, and I'm sure he'd be happy to come at the end of the testifier list and answer any questions about Big Stone 2 directly. Since I have not testified before this committee for quite some time, I'll just give a background here. Otter Tail Power is a small investor-owned utility that serves western and northwestern Minnesota. We serve 150 small rural communities in rural Minnesota and about 1,500 farms. Let me say first, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that Otter Tail Power recognizes the growing concern for climate change and the need to make reductions in greenhouse gases. In fact, between 1990 and 2005, Otter Tail Power actually decreased its carbon intensity at its generation plants by nearly 11%. We plan to decrease our carbon intensity another 11% by 2020. Otter Tail Power is also committed to meeting the new requirements of the Minnesota Renewable Energy Standard that Representative Peterson authored and the governor signed last week. On the conservation front, our company has achieved more than 1 million megawatt hours of conservation since we officially launched conservation programs in 1990. We realize that conservation is our best source of new energy. We will be actively engaged in further discussions with other stakeholders this session to optimize our company's commitment to electric conservation. Let me start first by suggesting what I think Minnesota should do. My company supports proposals in the governor's bill mentioned by Deputy Commissioner Garvey and in Representative Root's bill to do these things. First, to initiate a stakeholder planning process to recommend policies for achieving greenhouse gas reductions throughout the Minnesota economy. Second, to assess the state's capacity for effectively achieving greenhouse gas reductions in all sectors of the Minnesota economy. Third, to coordinate our state's efforts with actions occurring or being planned at the federal level. And in that regard, I will mention that our company is, like most utilities, is a member, industrial utilities, is a member of the Edison Electric Institute, and EEI officially supports federal action on climate change. And finally, what should Minnesota do? We should engage, as Deputy Commissioner Garvey suggested, the Center for Climate Strategies to assist our state in developing a full menu of options for achieving real greenhouse gas reductions. What do we think Minnesota should not do? What our company opposes is Minnesota taking unilateral action to cap greenhouse gases at the state level. This has a number of problems from our perspective. The first is that a single state cap and trade system cannot be efficient. Even multi-state regional cap-and-trade systems are too small to provide maximum efficiency. If you'll recall from your Econ 101 class, a market with many buyers and few sellers creates very high prices. In 2006, the Chicago Climate Exchange traded 10.2 million offset shares. If Big Stone 2 had been a part of that market, Big Stone 2 alone would have consumed 4.7 million of those offsets. Adding to the discussion we just had concerning the Excelsior project, that plant, together with the Big Stone 2 project, Big Stone 2 alone is 46% of the market that was traded in 2006. Some additional numbers from Mesaba, for example, would create an even higher percentage. If that higher percentage is added to the market, it's going to have a significant impact on price. A second reason Minnesota should not move ahead on its own is for electric utilities, no technology currently exists to cap CO2 emissions on existing generation plants. When the Congress passed the SO2 cap and trade program for reducing acid rain in the 1990s, utilities could decide to go out and buy SO2 scrubbers, or they could buy allowances in a national, well-developed SO2 allowance market. But with CO2, there are no CO2 scrubbers on the market today. Yes, there are R&D efforts taking place to develop CO2 scrubbers for existing plants, and we believe they will exist years down the road. Various technologies appear to hold promise for this, but there is no off-the-shelf technology that utilities can buy for this purpose today or in the near future. Minnesota's electric loads continue to grow, and no new electric baseload plants are currently under construction in our state or around it. This should concern us all. Now, I've provided a graph for all of you that should be laying somewhere in front of you. This graph that I've given you provides a forecast of what we call the electric generation reserve margins that are forecast by the Mid-Continent Area Power Pool. The National Electric Reliability Council, of which MAP is a part, recommends a 15% reserve margin for the MAP region. Without the addition of the Big Stone 2 plant, the Midwest Reliability Organization, which is the successor to MAP, is currently forecasting a 568 megawatt capacity shortfall by 2011 and a 2400 megawatt capacity shortfall by 2014. These dates are not that far away. I should point out also that a renewable energy standard that Representative Peterson authored and Governor Pawlenty signed last week assumed the conclusions of the MPUC's, the Minnesota Public Utility Commission's, wind integration study. The wind integration study assumed the existence of Big Stone 2 and about 3,400 megawatts of other new baseload coal plants, as well as hundreds of megawatts of new gas peaking plants and the transmission lines that are associated with each of those plants. All of these resources are critical to Minnesota's ability to provide reliable electric service to its citizens in the future, and they're critical to providing the infrastructure necessary to deliver the renewable energy standard that we all have agreed to over the past few weeks. I'd like you to keep in mind that every time someone buys something at Best Buy or a Target that plugs into the wall, electric demand increases. For example, your typical 5 to 10-year-old Sony television uses about 85 watts. If you go out and buy a new 42-inch LCD flat screen TV, your use increases to about 135 watts. And if you buy a 42-inch plasma TV, now you're at 550 watts. In industrial markets, new ethanol and biodiesel plants are being proposed across the state. one of them for Fergus Falls, where I live. Oil and gas pipelines are increasing their capacities of their transmission lines across Minnesota. They need bigger motors and more electric capacity. Potential new customers want to build new industrial facilities in our state. I'll just mention Senator Bach's reference on the Senate floor a couple of weeks ago to a new potential steel mill on the range as an example. Where is the electricity for all these new electric demands going to come from? Let me personalize this just a bit for my company. Let me suggest that Minnesota should not make the mistake of imposing caps that prevent the construction of modern, new coal generation facilities. My company's oldest coal plant is located in Fergus Falls. It's called Hoot Lake Plant. It only generates 122 megawatts of electricity, but it's still an important part of our base load energy mix. Our study suggests that we may be able to retire Hoot Lake Plant by 2017. Its two units were built in 1954 and 1959. But if we're prevented by a premature state CO2 cap and trade program from constructing our company's share of Big Stone 2 generating plant, which is, by the way, 115 megawatts, we will be forced to keep running our Hoot Lake plant. Let me point out that the old plant in Fergus Falls generates just 811 kilowatt hours per ton of CO2. Big Stone 2 plant will generate 1,051 kilowatt hours per ton of CO2. That's a CO2 efficiency improvement of almost 30%. Other emissions efficiency gains for SO2, NOx, and mercury are even more dramatic. What Minnesota would really be telling my company by passing a Minnesota-only cap-and-trade or carbon offset program is that we can't buy the modern new hybrid vehicle that we need to continue going to work every day unless we're willing to pay a fee every year.
Excuse me, Mr. Logtag, if you could wrap it up and then
finish it. Mr. Chair, I'm very close to the end.
Thank you.
Unless we pay a fee every year for CO2 emissions, or our other choice is to keep our old inefficient 1950s car. Don't buy that hybrid until a new zero-emissions car is available. Given these choices, most Minnesotans would want to see a price tag attached to each of the options before they make a decision. In conclusion, my company stands ready with all the other electric providers in Minnesota to study all aspects of achieving sustainable reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, and we would recommend the provisions in these bills that I mentioned earlier that will work toward that end. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Logtag. Any questions at all? Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Logtag, I was just wondering if you know from your Fergus Falls plant what the mercury emissions are from that plant currently and what the mercury emissions would be from the Big Stone 2 if it were approved.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'll do my best to recall these off the top of my head. The mercury emissions at Hoot Lake Plant, my best recollection is that they're around 45 to 50 pounds of mercury per year. The Big Stone 2, the Big Stone plant, the existing Big Stone plant emissions are 189 pounds per year. When Big Stone 2 is built, the combination of the two plants together, I'll keep in mind Big Stone 1 is about 460 megawatts, Big Stone 2 is 630. The two plants together, the gentleman who spoke earlier, I believe is correct, we've estimated it's going to take us 2 or 3 years to fine-tune the mercury control system. And that's the best estimate on our part. But when we've completed that, we will be still at 189 pounds of mercury per year for two plants, even though the output's, I think, almost 2.5 times what the existing plant is.
And Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Lockhead. I'm glad you
brought up the subject of supply and demand and saying that's part of economics 101. Some of us have taken economics 101 and 201 and 301 and 401 and advanced statistics, and I guess if you're going to use this graph to show us what dire consequences will happen if Big Stone doesn't get built, if you could include sources so we could corroborate this data and give us the assumptions on which they're based, because all I'm seeing is this reverse Malthusian curve that shows us that we're all going to turn the lights off if we don't build this plant, and I would like a little bit more convincing case than what I'm seeing here. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Rogley, did you want to respond?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, the graph that I've handed out is information that was generated as part of the Big Stone proceedings of the Public Utilities Commission. It was submitted as evidence and accepted by all parties as evidence, is my understanding. And I would be happy to dig around a little bit and find some more information for you.
Any other questions? Representative Brainard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is really a follow-up to Representative Gardner's, but I'm wondering if this graph includes any consideration of the effects of conservation or efficiency on consumption.
Mr. Logbeck.
Mr. Chair and Representative Reiner, this graph is a best estimate from MAP data information that includes all sources of information that would include, for example, all load management efforts by the utilities in the MAP region. It also includes their conservation efforts. Yes, that would be normally filed as a part of our integrated resource plan. We provide data to MAP saying, here's what we project our future loads to be, and they aggregate that and they develop this kind of data.
Representative Brainard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a point of clarification. I'm not simply talking about conservation efforts on the part of utilities, but a more comprehensive approach to conservation and efficiency and how that might affect demand and hence the projections for future usage, because I think that's a really critical factor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brainard, you're correct in suggesting that this does not include changes that are under review, for example, in the conservation program legislation that's currently before committees in both the House and the Senate. So those could have some impact here, yes, they could.
Any further questions? Okay. Thank you. And we have gone beyond 6 o'clock, but we have four other testifiers. If I hear no objections, I think we could just continue moving along. So, okay. Mr. Rick Lancaster, if you could step forward, please. Thank you, Mr. Lancaster. If you could state your name for the tape, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon or good evening, I'm not sure which it is at this point. My name's Rick Lancaster. Thanks for including me on your agenda. I'm Vice President Generation at Great River Energy. We're a not-for-profit electric cooperative with a headquarters in Elk River. We provide electricity at wholesale to 28 distribution cooperatives who in turn serve 600,000 consumers in Minnesota. Our member service areas cover about 60% of the state, and about 1.5 million people live in the homes that we serve. Let me say, first of all, that Great River Energy, we're very concerned about global warming. We have a goal at GRE of reducing our CO2 emissions to year 2000 levels by 2020. We've been a leader in renewable energy development. Last year, the renewable energy requirement in Minnesota for electric utilities was 2%. And our actual renewable energy production was about 4%. We'll have over 10% renewables by 2009, and we're on track to have 20% renewables by 2020 and 25% by 2025. I know that Minnesotans want the global warming problem to be addressed, but I also know they expect it to be addressed with the lights on. I'm very concerned about provisions of House File 375 that show a disregard for electric reliability. I'm particularly concerned about provisions that it was originally Section 6, now it's Section 5 in the Strike Everything Amendment that would prohibit the construction of natural gas, fuel oil, or coal-fired power plants and would prohibit the import of power from outside the state while the process of creating a cap-and-trade program occurs. These prohibitions would occur regardless of the growing demand for electricity in our state. Developing a cap-and-trade program could be a lengthy process. If we are prohibited from building even natural gas peaking plants during that process, the reliability of the electric system in this state will be severely impaired. We have a natural gas power plant under construction today, just north of Cambridge, whose construction would be halted if this bill were to pass before the project was complete. The provision of House File 375 that would halt the import of power from outside the state if it was from a new natural gas, oil, or coal plant would be very difficult to implement. Our electric power system is an interconnected grid that stretches from the Atlantic Ocean to the Rocky Mountains, from Saskatchewan down to Florida. We rely on power from outside the state to keep the lights on here in Minnesota. When we buy power from the MISO market, which is the regional market we buy from, we don't typically know which plant or plants it comes from. For this reason, a federal cap-and-trade program makes more sense than a state program. Mr. Logtag, my predecessor, made some comments about Big Stone 2. We're a Big Stone 2 partner also. I won't say everything I was going to say about that project, just that if it came online tomorrow, it would be the most efficient large coal-fired power plant in the United States, and therefore the lowest emitter of CO2. I gave your staff a handout from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. They've identified supercritical pulverized coal plants with CO2 capture as part of a carbon-constrained future in the world. This is the same panel of government scientists who've said that there's a 90% chance that humans are responsible for global warming. Dr. Meyer from the Union of Concerned Scientists referred to them in his testimony. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in this report has a view of a carbon-constrained future that includes plants like Big Stone 2 with CO2 capture. I'm quite certain that Big Stone 2, if we were allowed to build it, will one day be retrofitted with CO2 capture technology. That technology is not commercially available today, but it is used in small-scale applications, and we are participating in research with the Electric Power Research Institute and also the University of North Dakota to develop CO2 capture technologies in ways that can be applied to large-scale power plants. If you have been told that once Big Stone 2 has been built, we'll never be able to capture CO2 from it, then you've been told wrong. There are things that Minnesota can do. You've already done a lot this year when you passed the 25% renewable energy standard. I believe that's the best single thing the legislature can do to address global warming at this time. The 25% renewable energy standard was preceded by the wind integration study. Although I believe the results of that study are sometimes misinterpreted, it was a necessary precursor to the 25% bill to assure us all that 25% renewables would not degrade the reliability of the very complex and important electric power system that we all rely on. We've talked some today about carbon offsets language that's in the bill. There's a lot of questions that will come up about that. Answering those questions is one thing that would make the process longer. For example, how would a qualified offset be defined? Are such offsets realistically available now and in sufficient quantities, as Mr. Logtag alluded to? There's very strong language in there about permanent, quantifiable, verifiable, and enforceable offsets that would not otherwise occur. I feel that I know what those words mean. But would everyone agree with my definitions? If there's disagreement, how would that be resolved? How long would that take? Until you get answers to these questions as part of a comprehensive plan for addressing climate change, you run the risk of creating a system that will not be workable. Global warming legislation should be preceded by a comprehensive understanding of the effects that it will have on the electric power system, just as the 25% renewable energy standard was preceded by the wind integration study. I urge you to develop a comprehensive climate change reduction plan through a process that involves all stakeholders, not just electric utilities, regulatory agencies, and environmental groups, but also businesses
and low-income consumers whose competitiveness and livelihoods may be affected by the outcome. I agree with and support your desire and the desire of Representative Rood to address the global warming problem, but like most Minnesotans, I would like to see you do it with the lights on. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lancaster. Any questions? And seeing none, next on the list.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have Ms. Deb Bergen. And from South Dakota. So.
Yes, I flew in just before the storm this morning, okay. And I don't think that my 10:30 flight's going to leave tonight.
Well, thank you for joining us. So, if you could state your name for the tape, please.
Absolutely. My name is Deborah Bergen. I'm with Missouri River Energy Services of Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I'd like to thank the committee members for this time today. A little bit about Missouri River Energy Services. We are a not-for-profit municipal power agency. We serve municipal electrics in four states, Iowa, North and South Dakota, and Minnesota. We have 60 members in those four states. 24 of those members are located here in Minnesota, mostly along the western border with North Dakota and South Dakota, where those cities are located. We at Missouri River Energy Services understand the desire of lawmakers in Minnesota to take action on climate change. However, we have reservations on taking state-specific action, and it should be approached with the utmost caution. MRS is concerned that in a rush to pass state-specific legislation, unintended consequences could result in cost impact to customers and create market imbalances. In order to address climate change as well, we must look at all industry segments at all considerations and to make sure we're doing it right. Global warming isn't that global in nature, and any approach should be on a national, if not global, basis, but should also look at other states. For example, MRES have members in four states, and action in one state does affect consumers and costs in other states. Incidentally, in House File 375, Subdivision 3, Section 5 recommends working with surrounding states on climate control. This is a step in the right direction. This is what should be done. Minnesota can't be an island. In order to address climate change, the federal government should take lead in developing policy applicable to all states, but Minnesota should also work with the adjacent states on making policy, marketing, cap and trade decisions, economic development considerations, and looking at potential rate impacts and potential impacts on jobs. I would note that the governor's bill as well forms a task force composed of stakeholders as well as representatives of several state agencies. This group would be charged with identifying and developing climate change plans across all economic sectors, industry sectors, and energy use. It would be able to look at all the considerations on the status of greenhouse gas control technology and its cost effectiveness, as well as maintaining electric reliability and the impacts on economic development. We support this type of approach. In addition, MRS would recommend that any cap and trade system or policy in Minnesota be administered by the Department of Commerce. The department already works with utilities on integrated resource plan filings with conservation improvement programs and is involved in the certificate of need proceedings. The staff with vast industry experience would be in the best position to administer policies affecting utilities. Any climate change legislation aimed at the utility industry in general, though, must consider the demand for electricity, and you've heard a lot about that today. It's been estimated by the CapEx 2020 group that the region's demand will increase another 6,300 megawatts by 2020, and this is despite conservation efforts. So even with the renewable standard, the aggressive renewable standard passed by the state legislature this year, according to the wind integration study itself, the region is still going to need another 5,000 to 6,000 megawatts of firm baseload generation to meet that demand. And likely all of this new generation is going to be some form of thermal generation, likely natural gas or coal-fired generation. The wind integration study also assumed in its statements that almost 4,000 megawatts of new coal-fired generation plans to be online by 2020. And in the wind integration study report, this indicated that these base load plants would be needed to sustain reliability,
to follow the fluctuations in load and demand and to provide power when wind is spotty or not available and to keep the lights on. One new facility needed for this need and for reliability is the Big Stone 2 project. Its associated transmission would serve Minnesota and it's needed and is needed for renewable energy. And in fact, again, the wind integration study relied on the fact that this transmission, the Big Stone 2 transmission, as well as the CapEx groups 1 and 2 would be in place, and that there would be additional transmission lines built to support that renewable energy standard. Further, demand is not going down anytime soon. MRS will need new power by 2012 to meet the growing needs of our members. If Big Stone 2 were not built, we would be forced to build natural gas peaking facilities in the short term, which also emit greenhouse gases in order to meet this demand. Natural gas is also subject to market price fluctuations, and as a not-for-profit entity, cost to the customer is a concern. Additionally, MRS would be forced to buy power on the market, again subjecting our members, our customers, to great fluctuations in prices and a higher cost. Over this period of extreme cold we recently weathered through, there were periods in which power sold on the spot market for $360 per megawatt hour, over five times the average spot market price. Owning our own base load generation is much less volatile, and it's superior and more economical than relying on the market. It promotes stability of price and reliability of resources for our customers. Additionally, utilities have no control where this purchased power is generated from. It could very well come from older, higher carbon emitting resources in other states. Some believe that all this new demand for electricity can be met from wind because wind's always blowing somewhere, someplace, sometime. Yet again, according to the Minnesota Wind Integration Study, there are times in which the wind is not blowing anywhere in this region. In fact, this actually just occurred this past month. During the coldest part of this year, and at the same time, MISO called for a generation alert due to extreme shortage of generation in the MISO footprint. MRES's wind generation was actually using power, not generating power. And this was, in fact, a common occurrence for all generation, wind generation, in Minnesota, Iowa, North and South Dakota during that same time period. However, HS 375 would impose a moratorium building or purchasing power from any new greenhouse gas emitting generation facility until at least such time a cap and trade system is in place, whenever that may be. This would effectively ban any new resource, even peaking facilities, other than possibly wind generation. There are some exceptions, but however, the purchase of credits, as you've already heard, is not widely available right now, and retiring a carbon-emitting facility is not an option for some utilities. For example, like MRES, we do not have a facility that could be retired at this time, so that option is unavailable to us. So I urge this committee to consider a balance on a climate change policy. Any legislation should be based on a complete study of the options and in cooperation with other states, should consider the national scope of the issue, and it should apply to all industries, not just utilities, should consider the status of technology and its cost effectiveness, and maintain reliability. The power supply and transmission system, as you well know from the evidence presented during the renewable energy standard debate, is very complex, and unintended consequences could be disastrous. Like the wind integration study did, I would encourage any study and a work group to look into the potential impacts on rates and reliability. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Bergen. And Representative Brainard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking again at this map that shows states that already have CO2 caps and wondering about this issue of state-specific consequences. We've heard about that a couple of times tonight, the risk of unintended consequences. There are several states we have to look at here, and I'm wondering if there's any data from any of those states that support the argument against state-specific standards.
Ms. Bergen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Reiner, I really don't have that answer for you. Unfortunately, I don't.
And Representative Borghinius has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
and thank you for coming here from South Dakota in this weather. The testimony has been that at some point Big Stone will capture its carbon, and you've just been asking us to consider cost effectiveness. How much per kilowatt hour is it going to cost Minnesota customers to have a Big Stone with carbon capture?
Ms. Bergen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I'm not familiar with that answer. My general understanding is that even with a carbon-constrained society, that Big Stone 2 would still be efficient power, and it would be less overall than purchasing on the market. But I do not have exact numbers for you.
And I was told that there's a Mr. Schultz here who may be able to answer
Mr.
the question. Thank you, Mr. Schultz. If you can state your name for the tape.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Bob Schulte. I am a chief executive officer of Central Minnesota Municipal Power Agency, a municipal public power group consisting of about 12 municipal utilities in southern Minnesota. I'm also a consultant to the Big Stone 2 project. With response to the question, as I understand it, what would be the cost of capturing and sequestering carbon from Big Stone 2? Is that correct? Representative Rubenis, is that close?
Yes. What does that add to the rate base per kilowatt hour?
Currently, because the technology is in development, there really isn't a way to put on a cost right now of today what it would cost to capture and sequester, because it's still in research and development stages. So the dollars per megawatt hour number is not really available or developed in the industry, not just for the Big Stone 2 project, but in the industry. Electric Power Research Institute that Ms. Bergen referred to, who is the source of research, or one of the main research agencies for the utility sector, has studied the comparison of potentially capturing carbon dioxide from a pulverized coal unit like Big Stone 2 versus other coal technologies, and has found in a recent study that the pulverized coal technology that Big Stone 2 will be using would be very amenable compared to other coal technologies in the future when the technology is ready and the cost for carbon management come to a point where it's cost effective to do so. I mean, if the cost of carbon and carbon management gets to a high enough point, the cost of the capture technology happens, then that would be taken as an alternative to other things that the utilities might do at that time. It might be cheaper at that time to do even more conservation. It might be cheaper at that time to capture and sequester. It depends on the marketplace and what the technology allows us to do.
Representative Wagenius.
But we're looking at this time, not at that time. We're looking at now, and we've been asked by you all to consider cost effectiveness, and we can't do that unless you all can tell me. I know the cost of Big Stone per kilowatt hour is high, and I'm worried about the cost of adding carbon capture to it, but without an answer of what it means today, it's hard to say that it's going to be cost effective.
Chairman, Representative Rubinius, the part of that question that is missing in this whole discussion is, what is the value of carbon capture? What is the dollar per ton, for example, that should be put on carbon? That has been missing from this debate. If we do put a number of goals out there, a part of our concern, if we put a number of goals out there without the planning that would go behind it, and just put goals out there, that might be assuming a very, very, very high cost of carbon, where we'd be better off, we would be making bad decisions, when really actually putting in the coal plant is a good idea. Even if you consider a reasonable number for what a dollar per ton of carbon probably will be when these markets are developed that we're talking about here. So what is missing is, what is the specific value that we're going to put on a ton of carbon? I mean, that's the whole discussion here. A cap and trade program
what would an offset cost? What value are we putting on carbon? And until we have that discussion via the type of stakeholder process that we're talking about, you don't really know what the cost effectiveness of various alternatives are. If you raise the cost of carbon, that will raise the apparent cost of a carbon-emitting source. Okay, how much is the cost of carbon going to go up? What's the reasonable range? Some of the numbers that we saw earlier on a chart when one of the earlier speakers showed some numbers that were used in the South Dakota site permits process for Wheatstone 2. Those numbers at the high end, I remember, roughly, I remember the mid-value and the high end were like $19 a ton and $35 a ton. Okay? That's what was driving the numbers that you saw there. That was what was presented in South Dakota. Whereas numbers, say, that are talked about in various bills, say at the federal level, are probably in the range of $5 to $10 a ton. So it depends on the value you put on carbon. If you putting in just a more or less arbitrary goal out there without a determination of what specific value are we putting on carbon, which we all want to reduce, then you're going to get wrong answers and inappropriate decisions. And these are big, big dollar decisions that we're making based on very little data, unless you have that assumption.
Okay. Representative Guineas.
We have a value that we're talking about. I thought everybody had agreed that the value was that we were going to reduce global warming or reduce carbon, so we would not have the kind of global warming. And I think perhaps the values that you're talking about and my values are very different. I was just asking you for the simple cost of what it is per kilowatt hour to add the equipment to capture the carbon. So if you don't have an answer, that's fine. I appreciate not having the answer.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Schulte. Any other questions at all? Okay, and thank you, Ms. Bergen. I hope you're not held here in Minnesota too much longer. So moving on to Mr. John Knapp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Knapp, and I'm representing Partners for Affordable Energy. Partners for Affordable Energy supports the goal of cost-effective global greenhouse gas emission reduction, but we are concerned that House File 375, as currently drafted, fails to consider some important realities of today's energy environment. Partners for Affordable Energy is a regional coalition that is an advocate for low-cost, reliable, and environmentally compatible coal-based electricity. Founding members include coal producers and electric service providers, including utilities and rural electric cooperatives in both North Dakota and Minnesota. One important reality of today's energy environment is that state-level action on greenhouse gas reduction will have a relatively little effect on atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide. As we know, much of the greenhouse gas problem comes from outside the U.S. borders. Another reality is that federal action on greenhouse gas controls is quite likely. Both House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid have called for federal legislation on climate change during 2007. Matter of fact, Speaker Pelosi has called for that legislation to be passed the House by June 1st of this year. With federal legislation imminent, state by state or regional efforts to draft climate change legislation may conflict with a federal program and increase costs to Minnesota consumers. Electric utilities, as we also know, are not the only source of man-made carbon emissions. According to the EPA's most recent greenhouse gas inventory, about 33% of man-made emissions come from electricity generation, and 28% come from the transportation sector. The remaining 39% come from the industrial, residential, agricultural, and commercial sectors. An effective policy needs to address all major emission sources, not just electric generating facilities. Actual emission reduction performance can only be as good as the available technology. While many promising technologies are currently being tested, we still appear to be some years away from a widely applicable and commercially cost-effective technology to capture or reduce greenhouse carbon dioxide emissions on a wide scale. Cost is an important issue that should not be overlooked. Minnesota's economy has benefited significantly from our relatively low energy costs, which have provided us with a competitive advantage for businesses locating or expanding here. Individual ratepayers also benefit from these low costs. There has not been an economic study that analyzes the effect of a state greenhouse gas initiative. Partners for Affordable Energy supports Article 5, Section 4 of Representative Hilty's bill, House File 436, which is also the governor's proposal, which calls for an independent expert to conduct a structured series of stakeholder meetings to review potential policies and initiatives that could be undertaken. Importantly, this climate change action plan should include a cost-benefit analysis, which would provide useful guidance in developing state strategies on greenhouse gas reduction. We believe that Minnesota's energy policy must ensure a future energy supply that is environmentally responsible, but is also affordable and reliable. We look forward to working with the author and the committee as this legislation progresses through the committee process. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Knapp. Any questions at all? Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Knapp, was Partners for Affordable Energy around in the 80s? How long have you been in existence?
Mr. Knapp.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moe, we've been in existence for about 8 years.
Right. So it might not apply. I remember the arguments back when we were first looking at acid rain, nitrous oxide, sulfur dioxide emissions, and I remember hearing a lot of energy producers feeling as though Minnesota can't be an island. You know, we do this, power costs are going to go up, we're going to drive business out of the state, et cetera, et cetera. And correct me if I'm wrong, it seems to me that Minnesota was one of the leaders in establishing state standard, and we drove the national debate, didn't we? Perhaps were key to actually getting federal standards. And I look at this map that we have in front of us about all the different states who are coming up with standards for greenhouse gas emissions. And how is this any different?
Mr. Knapp. Mr.
Chairman, Representative Moe, you're correct. Minnesota was a leader in reducing SO2 emissions. I think this is a little different in a couple of ways. And I think you heard some testimony earlier on sulfur dioxide and what had been done. But one key difference is that there is technology available to reduce or eliminate sulfur dioxide in the emissions systems of coal generating plants. That technology just simply is not now available for carbon. So that's one fundamental difference that we ask the committee to consider.
Representative Moe.
Mr. Chairman, it seems to me, though, that would be an indictment for building any additional coal-fired power plants because that technology isn't available.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moe, hopefully, we all hope that technology becomes available. What cost that technology will be at, we don't know. And there may be certain types of coal plants that the technology will be suited for and other types that it may not be suited for. But at the same time, we do have an ever-increasing population and an ever-increasing demand for energy in the state.
Representative Moe.
Mr. Chairman, but we do know that global warming is real. We do know that the costs are real. We do know that where I live, tourism is extremely important. Changes in climate have been dramatic in their effects already to our tourism-based economy. I think it seems your arguments for because we don't know the costs of carbon sequestration for coal technology, it seems strange to me that we would go down that road then.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moe, I think there are two types of costs that we're talking about. We are for certain talking about the technological costs of in the electricity generation process. There also may be costs to the state's economy from jobs that don't come here, factories that don't get built, or commerce that doesn't take place because of higher energy costs. We just don't know. What we're suggesting is that it seems reasonable to us to look at the benefits from reducing carbon. We certainly don't disagree with that. Let's look at the costs for reducing carbon, and then let's make a judgment. You know, what is the best bang for the buck?
You're Representative Moe.
One more. And I appreciate you coming here, and all fairness, I'm somewhat biased here, but it's again, you know, it seems to me if we're researching, trying to figure out what the costs of carbon sequestration will be for this technology, why would we build a plant? why would we build one or two additional old technology coal-fired power plants? Even though, I mean, it's new compared to what we built in the 50s and 60s, but still, I mean, it does seem to be the previous millennium source of generating electricity.
Mr. Knapp.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Moe, I wouldn't at all diminish the significance of the legislation that you've already passed, setting a renewable energies standard for this state. I didn't hear the testimony here this evening, but certainly in the Senate there was testimony that the effect of the RES that you've already passed is going to be to substantially reduce carbon emissions in Minnesota. So I think you've already accomplished something very significant and substantial already this session that's going to reduce carbon emissions.
Thank you. And Representative Moe, another one.
And I think you would agree with this. We have a long ways to go, however.
Mr. Knapp.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moe, we do in Minnesota, and we do nationally, and we do internationally.
Thank you.
And somewhat along the same lines that what Representative Moe was asking about as far as the technology not being available currently for the capture and sequestration, as far as the sulfur dioxide, were there caps or limits being placed in different states prior to the development of the technology that was eventually successful in removing that?
Mr. Chairman, that's an excellent question, and I do not know the answer to that.
The reason I was asking is it seems to me that caps or limits would obviously create an incentive to develop that technology, so it could be an incentive for that reason. But, Representative Breinart, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to refer back to earlier testimony by Alden Meyer. He had indicated the economic benefits of establishing targets or goals, and you're raising concerns about the economic impact on electricity and the economy, but one of the things we talked about both when we in the renewable energy standard and in this context are the economics incentives for establishing a target in terms of potential new industry and incentives for creative technology with that standard in place. And he put it in a much broader context than I could, but that would be my counter argument to the caution that you raised, and I'd be interested in your response to that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Breinert, I think you raise a very good point. I don't dispute at all that there could be some benefits from carbon control legislation. There also, I think, indisputably are going to be some costs, and all we're saying is let's look at all the benefits and look at all the costs and then make a reasoned judgment.
Any further questions? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Knapp. And we have Mr. Michael Robertson. Welcome, and please state your name.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. It's a pleasure to be here tonight. I'd rather be somewhere else, actually. But my name is Mike Robertson. I'm environmental policy consultant to the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I have worked on environmental policy at the legislature for more than 30 years. During the 1980s, I was deputy and assistant commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency for 9 years. I had a dream when I was a little kid in Little League Baseball that someday I could bat cleanup. And I never got that chance in Little League Baseball. And unless there are other testifiers tonight, it looks like I get the bad cleanup tonight anyway.
Is that
ninth?
What? You're at the bottom of the order.
Well, but I get the final say. I get to hit the ball out of the park, right? I look at it in a positive way. But I understand that we are concerned about the climate outside and the changes that are occurring there. So I'm going to set aside the text that I have prepared and try to get directly to the point. I will repeat some of the points that have already been made, but I'll try to do it succinctly. We clearly understand that in the business community, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, the 2,600 members of the chamber, that there is an urgency to move forward on the issue of climate change. We know the political pressure that you have received in your campaigns, and we understand that we are at a tipping point with regard to this issue. We also believe, and as has been stated a number of times in testimony this evening, that you have taken major action this year, and you will take more action this year, we suspect, that will specifically address carbon emissions in a very significant way. When you look at some of those plans that have been developed by the Center for Climate Strategies with those other states, and there are 11 states that have done those plans, there are 7 states that the Center for Climate Strategies is currently working with, including Minnesota. When you look at a chart, a graph that they develop of the estimated emission reductions of the options that they look at over a period of 20 years, the greatest emission reductions are occurring from the development of renewable energy and improving energy efficiency and conservation. We understand that you will be looking further at the whole conservation issue. We know that Representative Kilkey's committee will be moving forward with legislation to improve energy efficiency and conservation. So those two things mean that this year you will take significant action. The question is, what should be the next step? We believe there needs to be a comprehensive state plan. You've heard that from Commissioner Garvey. I think you've heard it from Representative Rood that she agrees with the governor's approach. In our work with all of the stakeholders in our discussions thus far, we have heard no objections to the Center for Climate Strategies and the process that they use to evaluate options. So we think that that needs to be the next step. Now, the difference that we have with provisions that were included in the original bill of Representative Rood and still some provisions that are in the Delete Everything Amendment relate to predetermining the outcome of that process. And I want to get to a point that Representative Wagenius raised in her question to Commissioner Garvey. By saying you should wait to take some action is not saying that you shouldn't give direction to the group and is not saying that the legislature doesn't have the final decision-making authority about what action should be taken. I think the point with regard to the conversation about the interim goals is that we're not sure what the interim goals should be. The original bill and the current version of the bill and in the Delete Everything Amendment establishes a goal, and I would assume someone in looking at that as a constituent of the state would say, well, there must be really good reasons why they picked those interim goals. And I'm not aware of what the reasons are for the interim goals that have been selected in the bill, and I'm not sure that those are the appropriate goals. I don't disagree that there should be interim goals. I don't disagree that any legislation that directs the process that will occur with the Center of Climate Strategies should not be specific about what kind of goals they should look at and evaluate. The same goals that are in Representative Rood's bill could be in the planning section and direct the stakeholder process to specifically evaluate those goals and recommend whether they're the appropriate goals. So that's one of the points of contention that we not that the process not that decisions, major decisions on policy, not be made by the legislature without having adequate information. You've heard a lot of discussion tonight about cap and trade, about offsets, and whether cap and trade is appropriate at a state level. whether the offsets are going to cost too much, whether they're even possible to occur, how that will affect energy reliability in the state of Minnesota. I haven't heard adequate answers to those questions. I think that's what the purpose of the stakeholder process is, to provide the legislature with adequate information on major policy decisions. It was mentioned earlier that you had a very long process of looking at the issue of renewable energy standards and objectives. We've had experience with the renewable energy objective. You had the wind integration study that laid the basis for the standard that you passed and was signed by the governor last week. We think that taking this next step, spending some time in a reasonable, deliberate process with experienced technicians and experts from around the state and around the country, that we can come up with a plan that the legislature can look at in the next session and take more action and establish the long-term plan and lay the groundwork for action in the long term for our state, along with the significant action that you took this year with the renewable energy objective standard, rather. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to try to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Robertson. Representative Ordinius.
Thank you. You knew if you mentioned my name, I was going to have to respond. I'm actually glad that the chamber recognizes that we're at a tipping point. I think all of us have come a long way really quickly, and I'm really glad to hear that. What is troubling to me is your notion that the legislature should not set a target. Because in doing that, you're saying two things to us. It's not our job, and that the science isn't strong. The science is very strong right now, and I think Minnesotans expect us to do our job. So with that, and just to have a tiny bit of wrap-up to the wrap-up, I would appreciate it if we could ask Mike Noble if he would talk just a bit about the science to us.
Sure.
If that was, 'cause he's, I've heard him give very good summary statements of the science, and I, you know, so many of us have been to so many conferences over the last year. You just can't deny the science right now. And what the science is telling us we must achieve. And it's not, we cannot leave our responsibility to some technical experts to tell us what's best for Minnesota. It's our job now.
Mr. Robertson.
Representative Ogenius, you notice in my comments I referred to the interim goals in the bill. I didn't mention the 80% by 2050. I am aware of some of the science, and I'm not an expert in the science, and I think you should hear more about that science. But if it is the conclusion that that is the appropriate long-term goal, then that is an appropriate decision to make if you feel you've got enough information to make that decision. My point is the interim goals on how we get to that long-term goal, and I have not heard adequate analysis of why those goals were picked, whether they were the appropriate goals, and what will be the impact of those goals in the short and medium term.
And
Representative Lugenius.
Perhaps we also need to know the impacts of not meeting those intermediate goals. And so with that, I just like it if we could call Mr. Noble up for a few minutes. That would be all right.
I think there's a few other questions first, and then we
absolutely
do that. So Representative Moe has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Robertson, thank you for batting ninth or cleanup, whichever.
Cleanup,
yeah. And also I'd like to thank you and the rest of the chamber for being a member of the stakeholder process that's helped us to get as far as we have gotten. But I do share Representative Wilginius's concern that we do need to set some benchmarks, I think, within this. I mean, the 25 by 25 didn't come out of the stakeholder process. Actually, that was kind of externally imposed, and then within that stakeholder process, you were involved in actually coming up with a doable strategy to get there. And I think, again, showing great leadership in doing so, and so I appreciate that. I guess I would just encourage you, you know, we're going to come out of this with something, hopefully, a bill that's going to have some benchmarks in it. And the way we're going to succeed, the way we're going to get there is, again, by the Chamber, by Xcel and Minnesota Power, and being involved with us to get there. So I would assume that you'll do that, however, whatever bill we get out of the legislature with and pass the governor. And if we don't have your input and involvement, we're not going to succeed. So I would hope that you'll stay working with us on this.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative Mull, we will be there.
Thank you. Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair, I apologize for making a joke at your expense, Mr. Robertson. Your expertise and knowledge is always appreciated. But I have a question. You have a program within the chamber called Minnesota WasteWise that does solid waste technical assistance to help businesses save money and recycle more, reduce waste, and so on. Is there any discussion with the chamber going on about technical assistance to business on everything from recommissioning buildings ideas to calculating carbon footprint, et cetera? And if you haven't, let me suggest it. I think it would be a great idea. Without us having to do it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gardner, thank you for that softball question. I could hit that one out of the park.
See, in softball, the ninth hitter is really valuable.
Okay.
So that is the scheme there.
Yes, as a matter of fact, we are looking at what the chamber can do to work with the business community and individual businesses to achieve reductions in energy consumption and therefore reductions in CO2. You mentioned the chamber's WasteWise program. We view that as a model, and we're looking at that as a model for the development of a new program that would concentrate on energy. I was struck in some conversations with some experts in the field of energy efficiency when they said to me, you know, we have all these incentives in the Conservation Improvement Program, but people just don't use them. To reduce energy consumption in business or in our homes or wherever else it may be. What we need is to motivate our individual citizens and our business citizens. And what we would like to do within the chamber is develop a significant program, probably much bigger than the Minnesota WasteWise program, working with the state's utilities within the Conservation Improvement Program, on a marketing campaign for business that would target small and medium-sized business. As you know, many of the larger businesses have their own energy expertise to make those kinds of reductions. But in many cases, energy within the cost, the total cost of a business, is only a 2% or 1% or 2% item of their cost. And when they consider all the problems they have with healthcare costs and other costs that are more prominent in their daily conversation, they don't always get the energy. So what we want to do is develop an aggressive program, because when it all comes down to it, all of the stuff we're talking about comes down to changing our behavior as corporate and individual citizens of the state. And we can try to mandate that, and maybe that some of that will work. But in the end, it has to be a change of behavior, and that's what we hope to do with EnergyWise, or whatever we end up calling it. We're going to use the WasteWise program as a model to develop that kind of an effort.
Thank you. Representative Reinhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't going to say anything, but when you said about changing people's behavior, to me that's exactly what a cap system has the capacity to do. It will economically incent behavior change, you know, in a dramatic way for our state as a whole. So, and you know, that's what goals or targets are all about.
Mr. Chair, Representative Reinhart, right. I agree with you on the cap and trade. I think that that will end up, this is my personal opinion, that that will end up probably being the program that is established by the Congress on a national basis. The concerns we have and the questions that have not been answered with regard to a state-only cap and trade is how will that work with one state? And I know what the map shows. It shows California and the western states. It shows the eastern states. We have Minnesota in the middle. Even within a regional system like that, I'm not sure that the details have been worked out. We certainly haven't seen any analysis of how that trading system will work. If Minnesota set an auction for emission allowances for Minnesota, would those allowances be bought up by all some big utilities or industry in California or New York or the East Coast before our utilities or whoever would have to get those allowances within the state? There are a lot of questions about it. We think it should be studied. We want to be part of that evaluation and recommendation about whether it should can work as a state-only or a regional-only basis.
Representative Brainard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up. Illinois does sit in the middle here, so we could ask some questions about their experience. And, you know, I think your questions are legitimate, but it still doesn't convince me that that's a reason for holding off on action.
Mr. Chair, Representative Reinhart, I think Illinois was added to that map just within the last couple of weeks. I mean, this is happening so fast that I suspect that even the folks in Illinois don't have the answers to these questions. The Department of Commerce has begun to look at and has been looking at the issue of a regional system, whether that can work. There needs to be more work done on that. The stakeholders need to be a part of that and to understand what the impact of that would be.
Representative Saylor.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Robertson, I too would like to thank you or the Chamber for their efforts with Minnesota WasteWise. I'm familiar with that program and know that it has done many good things for people throughout the state of Minnesota. As you mentioned, looking at, you know, motivation and getting people to look at how they use things, I'm just struck by an advertisement that an unnamed area power company in my area recently had out that just said, leave the energy to us. Don't worry about it. Don't give it a thought. Leave it to us. And sort of that, what is everyone's, what is business's message? What is the legislature's message? What is everyone's message to the people of Minnesota? Do we just say, leave it all to us. We'll figure it out. I think that the citizens of the state do have a responsibility, and I think engaging them and the businesses is truly something not to be underestimated. The whole situation of global warming is very much an economic issue. I think about tourism and the timber industries, and there was an earlier reference to Minnesota possibly becoming similar to Kansas, and I don't recall the tourism or timber being major economic drivers in that state. I'm concerned that we look ahead to that future, and I think overall as legislators, as businesses, as leaders in the state and whatever, looking at, you know, what would be the implications of not doing something, of not moving in time, because you don't put glaciers back, you know, 3,000, 10,000-year-old glaciers. You don't put forests back very quickly. And I think that it behooves us all to really take that look at, you know, what happens if we don't do something in a serious situation in all aspects of how we move along. So I thank you for your willingness to look at helping out our businesses with that.
Mr. Robertson?
Yes. Thank you very much. I agree with everything you said.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, seeing none. And before we ask Mr. Noble to come down, are there any others in the audience who would like to testify? Seeing none, Mr. Noble, if you're available. Welcome, Mr. Noble. If you could state your name, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Michael Noble, Executive Director of Fresh Energy, and testifying on behalf of the Clean Energy Minnesota Coalition. I know my good friend, Mr. Arson, is delighted to see me get the cleanup job. Or the ninth hitter, I guess, is the metaphor has evolved. I just wanted to highlight some of the themes that we heard tonight and some of the major points that are in front of the committee for its consideration. You know, I want to thank my long friend and colleague, Dr. Alden Meyer, who came out today to remind us that the states that are going to move first are going to enjoy an advantage. And the advantage is preparing your economy for the inevitability of national policies that require the reductions of these global warming emissions. There really is no debate left as to whether we're going to reduce these emissions. Remember, for example, on the day before the President's State of the Union address, CEOs of 10 of America's largest companies called on the President to have a national and mandatory a reduction of carbon dioxide emissions, including four major power companies. There really is no disagreement about whether we're going to reduce these. I mean, we just heard the Chamber of Commerce of Minnesota saying it agreed with the idea that we have a state goal of reducing emissions by 80% over the next 40 or 50 years. So there doesn't seem to be much debate left about whether we're going here. And the advantage of being an early adopter, we get to prepare our economy for the inevitability. We get to help design a system that will benefit our state and benefit our state's industries. We get to gain experience in what's going to be new and innovative and different. No one is pretending to have all the answers. But I think, importantly, we're going to have a seat at the table nationally when the national debate is held. I mean, states are the laboratories of democracy. This is where policies get developed that trickle up instead of trickle down. We also heard from the administration that our views in Clean Energy Minnesota are aligned. There are some differences of nuance, but they're aligned that we too believe that the planning process that the governor has announced is the cornerstone. This is the cornerstone of Representative Rood's bill. We're not asking Minnesota to do it all or be the be-all and end-all, but for it to do its fair share. And we certainly agree with the governor's frequent comment lately that we're reaching a tipping point on this. We're reaching both a tipping point in the politics of this, and we're reaching a tipping point on the seriousness of the problem and the possibility of irreversible and truly harmful changes to our climate. We heard from both Reverend Peters and Molly Schultz about the growing concern out in the public. I don't know if you were adding up those numbers, but nearly 17,000 Minnesotans last year came out to public events and public hearings and forums on global warming. I don't know of social movements like that that bring those kind of people into church basements and church, I mean, more than church basements, overflow crowds in some of the biggest churches in Minnesota. So people are really, really concerned about this this issue. I do also want to address the idea that somehow this bill is about stopping the construction of the Big Stone power plant. I think that is very unfair to characterize the bill as targeting any particular project. Now, that project is going through an administrative process. In a few weeks, there'll be a recommendation to the Public Utilities Commission. There's a stack of information in front of the law judge, 6 inches high, and it just isn't the place to try the case in front of the committee. But what the administration is saying in the case, and what the record is showing in the case, and what our coalition is arguing in the case, is that the applicant hasn't met the burden of proof, it hasn't demonstrated it's in the public interest, hasn't demonstrated that it's needed, hasn't demonstrated that they can't meet these needs with efficiency and renewables. And the governor had added this interesting wrinkle that they haven't demonstrated that they could reduce the emissions, offset those emissions, so that Minnesota would have no net increase in carbon dioxide emissions if it were built. Now, Representative Dill asked the tough question about, well, this is just trying to prevent the construction. And, you know, we're not saying that the only new energy supply is going to come from energy efficiency and renewable energy. We're not saying that. I mean, I'm going to pass out a chart that shows that the energy efficiency bills that are being considered in the legislature and the renewable energy bill that's already signed into law. I mean, this line here, maybe I'll wait till I'll make this other point and I'll come back to that once you all have it and you can look at it. But we're not saying that energy efficiency and renewable energy is the only way to meet power supply in our state. And I'm just going to tick off some examples. These are all base load carbon-free or carbon-neutral or zero-carbon additions that have been made committed to by our utilities, our very excellent utilities. We have the St. Paul District Energy Plant that switched from coal to biomass, provides heat and cooling to all of downtown St. Paul, produces no carbon emissions. We have the refurbishment of the Allen S. King plant. They're going to get way more energy out of an old coal plant without burning more coal and without producing new carbon emissions. The conversion of the Highbridge coal plant downtown St. Paul and the conversion of the Riverside coal plant. Big net reductions in carbon dioxide emissions and big increase in energy output. We have on the Iron Range the conversion of old crummy district energy plants running on coal, converting them to high efficiency biomass. Big increases in energy output, big reductions in carbon dioxide emissions. We have announced this year the retooling of the Sherco Power Plant in the 70s. They're going to get more energy out of the Sherco Power Plant with the same amount of coal. You know, people know maybe that I'm not a big fan of nuclear power, but the Monticello plant is going to have a 200 megawatt increase in output, no increase in emissions. And for my good friends up in Fergus Falls, we're not saying that they can't build the Big Stone Power Plant and add for Otter Tail Power 115 megawatts of new energy. We're saying they should close that crummy old coal plant in Fergus Falls as their offset. That's what we're saying. And he says we're saying that they can't build a new Big Stone Power Plant. That's not what the bill says. So just to be clear about it, there are many technical options for adding power supply in our state. Many, many. The chart I've showed you shows you that the bill that passed into law last week on Thursday is the blue band here showing how much new electricity will be supplied with reductions of carbon dioxide emissions. And the energy efficiency band, the green band, is Senator Dibble and Representative Kalin's bill to dramatically increase our energy efficiency. So if we pass these two bills into law, 20 years from now, we'll have more energy going into the system and less carbon. So the idea that somehow a cap or a limit on carbon is very, very scary or very, very disruptive to the economy, you're passing the bills that accomplish this. That's what I'm urging you to see, is that it's not disruptive. Now, I know I've tested your patience and your time, but I just want to close with the point that Mr. Schulte and Mr. Lancaster and Mr. Lautick all made, was that the Big Stone coal plant could someday, maybe, if the carbon price were right, it could capture its carbon dioxide emissions. And an interesting thing that you got is you got two different people gave you a document today. Mr. Lancaster gave you this document for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and Dr. Alden Meyer gave you this document about the cost of coal with carbon impacts. And on page 10 of Mr. Lancaster's document, it says that the modeling that we did said that we'll begin to capture carbon from coal plants when the cost of carbon is about $30 a ton. And Dr. Meyer shows you that if the cost of $30 a ton to capture the carbon, is the cost from Big Stone would be approaching $100 a megawatt hour. Now, those of you who are not well-versed with this, that's about twice the market price of electricity. That's about twice the market price of wind power. That's about twice the market price of the testimony was it was cheaper than the spot market. Okay, maybe it's cheaper than the spot market, but it's not cheaper than energy efficiency. It's not cheaper than renewable energy. It's not cheaper than all those baseload examples I just gave you, that long list of baseload examples that utilities are willingly making on their own decisions. The idea that we should just build coal plants and figure it out later, that's putting it to the ratepayers and putting it to consumers. And this is a place where the governor and the chamber and the environmental groups should be aligned, not disputing that we shouldn't just be building coal plants and maybe later we'll figure it out. See my point? Maybe later we'll figure it out. It's not the right answer. Now, the very last thing I want to say before I test your patience way too far is I thought the most moving testimony today was from the high school kid. And the representative of MPERG. And, you know, I've been reading the science for a long time and maybe have too much of it. I've been doing this for about 15 years. And just one of my heroes in this is John Holdren. Now, John Holdren from Harvard University. She's the immediate past president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. I think he turned over the gavel last week. And John Holdren has written numerous books on the subject and spoken all over the world on global warming. And this is what he said yesterday in a report he gave to the United Nations following up on this big report that Mr. Lancaster gave you a chapter from. I was very grateful to see Mr. Lancaster distribute a chapter from it. But Mr. Holdren said, and he's just getting right down to the plain English, says climate change is real, it's already happening, it's already causing harm, it's accelerating, we need to do something about it, we need to do something about it seriously, starting now. Our specific conclusion is that if the world were to go past the point, tipping point, if the world were to go past the point of an increase in temperature above the pre-industrial levels, greater than 2 degrees, or 2.5 degrees, we would be in a regime where the dangers of intolerable and unmanageable impacts on the well-being would rise very rapidly. The targets in Representative Rood's bill are the targets that will keep us below increases of 2 to 2.5 degrees. They aren't randomly chosen. The reduction of 80% by 2050 is the kind of reductions we need in order to keep our world from warming up not more than 2 or 2.5 degrees. These are very dramatic warmings, 2 to 2.5 degrees, and what the past president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science has said is we can't risk going more than that. That is scary enough. So what the kids are telling you, the 17-year-olds telling you, that they want you to act, our generation has really botched this. You know, the fact that I have to tell my kids that I've been working on this for 15 years and the problem just keeps getting worse and worse and worse and worse, this bill is not too much too soon. This bill may be too little too late.
Thank you, Mr. Noble. Representative McNamara, I have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Noble, I'm just curious. I live a few miles and worked a few miles away from the Prairie Island nuclear plant, and I believe we're the only state in the nation that currently says that we wouldn't even consider nuclear power. And as I was listening to your testimony, I thought about if we were using more nuclear power and less of some of the very inefficient coal-fired plants, would we be putting less stuff into the air? And is your organization in favor of considering nuclear power?
Mr. Noble.
Representative Eakin, Representative McNamara. There's a illusion in America that nuclear power was killed by Main Street, local opposition. Nuclear power in America died because Wall Street walked away from it because of the risk and the cost. And there are many thoughtful people in this country who are asking the question about whether we should look again at nuclear power. But the hurdles that nuclear power has to overcome before it could be seriously considered is it first has to get in the ballpark on price. And second, it has to address its long-term waste management problem. And third, it has to convince Americans that no one could ever harm us either by damaging a nuclear power plant or by getting nuclear material out of the industry into the bad guys' hands. And that new high bar of the terrorism card is the problem that nuclear power didn't have a decade ago that it has now. I mean, without a doubt, nuclear power's really strong card is it doesn't produce carbon emissions, but it does have issues of cost, security, waste management that are still the challenge for the industry before it's going to be seriously considered again by the American people.
Mr. Chair, Mr.
Noble. Representative McNamara.
Is it a card in your deck?
Mr. Noble.
The book I'm reading right now is about nuclear power and what its liabilities and possibilities are. So I'm certainly thinking about it.
I just think, Mr. Chair, Mr. Noble, I just think it's unfortunate that we're a state that prides ourselves in doing such a great job of protecting our environment, and we've written into law that we don't even want to think about it. And I understand there's a lot of really tough discussion and thoughts on both sides of it, but the bottom line is we won't even talk about it today. I mean, we may talk about it, but we won't really consider it. And I think it should be a card in the deck for us to discuss. Maybe we don't play it, but I think it's a card that we should have before us.
Mr. Noble?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, if you really think that's the technology that we want to bet on, you should yourself take up the due diligence of asking the industry to satisfy you on those key points, the cost, the waste, and the security. And when you're confident, then you should introduce legislation to bring that back on the table for discussion. But I am not yet confident that we're there.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative McNamara.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Noble, we can't even have the discussion because it's a waste of time right now. I think your point is we should be reading the books. We should be having the discussion. It should be a card in our deck. I'm not saying we should play it. Mm-hmm. But it should be in our toolbox, and I think your point that it should be a card in our deck, or my point that it should be a card in our deck, is one. And currently, we don't allow it. We only got 51 cards in the deck.
And any other questions? Representative Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions. First, with regard to the nuclear issue, does your book have integral fast reactors in it? You're reading about that new technology. It's really good stuff. Anyway, the other issue I'm concerned about is that I believe in order to provide the baseload energy long-term that we're going to need, coal is going to remain a major player. And I'd like to get your opinion of the integrated gasification combined cycle type of processes, and where do you think they're at within the potential uses and availability here in Minnesota. When do you think that'll actually start to come into play? Mm-hmm.
Mr. Noble.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Osmond, integrated gasification combined cycle, or so-called coal gasification, you know, there's a lot of discussion on that all around the country, and my really fundamental view on that is show me the plan that captures the carbon and then we'll talk. The idea, again, that hey, we'll build it and we'll look at that later, that seems like the bad approach. Because if it's just a very, very expensive coal plant, you know, why not just build a very, very cheap coal plant? You got to have the technology that captures the carbon so you can at least come to the table. I mean, the Chamber of Commerce did a wonderful program last week, with one exception, the luncheon speaker. But they did a wonderful program last week on what's the future of baseload energy that's carbon-free. And what was interesting about it is everyone's asking the same question. How efficiency in renewables, they're going to be kind of the big engines, but they're not going to do it all by themselves. But the problem is people are asking us to support IGCC without capturing the carbon. So it's kind of like, why? What would be the point? If it doesn't address the global warming problem, why is it interesting?
Okay. And any other questions? Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Noble, and I appreciate your comments on my concern, too, is not so much that we're moving too fast, but maybe moving too slow. And I think that one of the problems we face, I think part of the reluctance to act sometimes is a fear of change, a fear of entering a new world, a new economy. I think that we have a lot to fear, though, for not changing. And I know there will always be questions about a changing world. You never know for sure what the new world will bring. But I think that somebody has to take the first step in order for any movement or change to take place. And I think that those who take the first step will be the ones who are going to step off front and take the lead and have a significant role to play in shaping the new economy that is to come. So, again, thank you all. I think it was a great discussion and great testimony given today. I would remind members that if there's materials, I would ask that you put the materials, including the delete all amendment and the bill, into your save file so that we don't have to reprint those for the next meeting, because we will be taking up the delete all to House File 375 on Tuesday and take up our discussion from there. So thank you and have a good weekend. Meeting adjourned.